This is the heart of London's financial district. Protesters, angered at being fenced in by police, refused permission to leave, began hurling bottles and sticks at police lines. There was a clear police tactic to close in a hardcore group of protesters.
There's a growing sense of frustration amongst these protesters who at the moment are not being allowed out by the police. Now, this is a police line just here. As you can see, people are now starting to throw things at them and they're pushing back against the crowds. There's a barricade there, so we can't get through. We're being pushed through by the police!
Earlier in the day, the Royal Bank of Scotland had been the target. Protesters smashing through windows. The bank has become a symbol here of everything that was perceived to be rotten with the banking sector. This was only a small portion of those present, but they were determined. The politicians are eager for the G20 to be remembered for big decisions, not mass violence. These pictures will ensure, at the very least, those who oppose the political and financial establishment will have their opinions heard.
Well, they're anti-NATO protesters, and they set that hotel and a border post on the River Rhine on fire this morning. And riot police had to fire volleys of tear gas and shock grenades to contain the violence.
You say they used everything, tear gas, flashballs, even a water cannon occasionally. It's been a kind of a cat and mouse game all afternoon long.
People are talking about being anti-globalization, being against NATO, being against nuclear weapons, being for ecology and a more environmental approach. Just about every cause you can think of gathered together and also some anarchists. And I think probably the damage that we saw was set by done by some of the anarchists in the crowd. They notably could be picked out because they wore black and wore black masks.
Yo, check this out, man. That was Last Week in Radical Efforts, and you are now listening to This Week in Radical History for the week starting April 6th.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes.
On this day, April 6th in 1712, a small group of African slaves in the city of New York staged a general revolt against their captors by burning a number of houses. The slaves were armed, and in the ensuing melee, 9 white people were killed. A state militia quickly convened to suppress the rebellion. The instigators, who were not killed in direct confrontations with the militia, were arrested and later publicly hanged, along with a number of additional suspects. This Day in History is a production of the Neighborhood Network in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis.
Also on April 6, 1878 in Germany, Erich Mischam lives, poet, anarchist, militant. During the Weimar Republic, he's known for his bitter satire, and as Hitler and the Nazi Party began to rise, he is an early opponent of them. After Hitler assumed power in 1933, they arrested Erich and tortured him for 15 months, including this report. Quote, after breaking his teeth with musket blows, stamping a swastika on his scalp with a red-hot brand, subjecting him to torture which caused him to be taken into the hospital. Even now, the fascist hyenas of the Sonnenberg concentration camp continue their beastly attacks upon the defenseless man. The last news is really atrocious. The Nazis forced our comrade to dig his own grave, and with the simulated execution made him go through the agony of a doomed man. Although his body has been reduced to a mass of bleeding and trembling flesh, his spirit is still very high. And when they tried to force him to sing the Nazi anthem, he defied their anger by singing the Internationale. Erich Mischam would be beaten to death in 1934. Also on April 6, 1952 in South Africa, one of the first mass meetings of non-whites to protest against apartheid, the same laws and government the U.S. backed for years to come. Also on this date in 1968, in the wake of the riots following the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., Oakland cops raid Black Panther Party headquarters. Police in Oakland, California open fire on a car of Black Panthers who are returning from a meeting. The Panthers escape their vehicle and run into the house. Police throw tear gas and riddle the house with machine gun bullets. After police set the building on fire, the Panthers try to surrender. 17-year-old Bobby Hutton comes out of the house with his hands in the air, but a police officer shouts, "He's got a gun." This prompts a barrage of police gunfire that leaves Hutton dead. The police would later admit that Hutton was not carrying a gun, but no one was prosecuted for this execution. This week in radical history for April 7th. In 1803, French socialist and one of the first modern feminists, Flora Tristan, lives. Also on that date, in 1872, Dr. Marie Ikoi lives, lesbian anarchist and labor organizer. Found guilty of sedition during World War I under newly amended Espionage Act for handing out a banner that read, "Prepare to die, workmen, J.P. Morgan and Company, want preparedness for profit," which would start a small riot. She'd be sentenced to 3 years in jail. Also on April 7, 1927, Setko and Fassetti are convicted in an armed robbery case where two guards are killed. On this date, a denial of what to become known as the Medeiros Appeal, a signed affidavit from a man claiming he did all of it, and that Setko and Fassetti had nothing to do with it, was denied as good enough reason for retrial, nor a stay of execution. Riots would break out in major towns in the U.S. and all over the world after the executions.
Beginning with the First World War, an alliance of the Departments of Justice, Labor, and Immigration initiated a campaign of repression. Agents broke into the homes of suspected radicals, arrested them, and seized their possessions. Many were deported. Most of the victims were foreigners, usually Russians, Italians, and Jews.
Two men stand out as targets of the anti-radical campaign. They were Italian-born, residents of Boston for many years, respectable workers and dedicated anarchists. They were attempting to dispose of some anarchist leaflets when they were arrested on a charge of armed robbery and murder. Their names were Nicola Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti.
Oh, Sacco Vanzetti, oh, Sacco Vanzetti, Sacco, Sacco Vanzetti, I just want to sing your name.
The state's evidence was flimsy, and the witnesses for the prosecution gave confused and contradictory testimony. Sacco and Vanzetti proclaimed their innocence, but they were convicted and sentenced to death. Appeal after appeal was denied. The case became an international cause. Marches and defense efforts were organized worldwide.
But on August 23, 1927, the state of Massachusetts, which had condemned Sacco and Vanzetti as violent and dangerous men, mobilized 500 heavily armed policemen to suppress protests and electrocuted the two Boston anarchists.
Last Anna's date in 1970, future acting President Ron Reagan and then Governor of California announces his attitude towards student rights activities, dissenters, and the Vietnam War protest by calling out state police and saying, "Well, if it takes a bloodbath, let's get it over with."
Yes, we have no bananas. We have no bananas today. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yes, we have no bananas. We have no bananas today.
On April 8, 1885 in Panama, yes, we also have no ripe bananas, as U.S. troops invade to protect American banana interests. Also on April 8, 1952, President Truman orders U.S. Army to seize the nation's steel mills to avert a strike and to break the unions. This act would be ruled illegal by the Supreme Court on June 2nd, a little too late. This week in radical history for April 9th, in 1908, President Teddy Roosevelt investigates legality of not only barring anarchist propaganda that advocates political violence, but also prosecuting those who produce materials. He says, quote, "When compared with the suppression of anarchy, every other question sinks into insignificance. The anarchist is the enemy of humanity, the enemy of all mankind, and his is a deeper degree of criminality than any other. No immigrant is allowed to come into our shores if he is an anarchist, and no paper published here or abroad should be permitted circulated in this country if it propagates anarchist opinions." Teddy Roosevelt.
Yes, we have no bananas. We have no bananas today. Yeah, yeah.
Ms. Pascal, what you're describing is anarchy. Are you an anarchist?
You mean, am I a member?
An anarchist group, yes.
Anarchists have a group?
I believe so, sure.
They assemble?
I don't know.
Wouldn't that completely defeat the purpose?
Yes, we have no bananas. We have no bananas today.
And on April 9, 1918, in Moscow, there is no love for anarchists there either, as an anarchist black guard confiscates a car of the American ambassador. The car is seized in an effort to effect the release of political prisoners and trade union militants imprisoned in America. This action serves as a pretext for the Bolshevik secret police, the Cheka, to mount a sweeping attack on the anarchists and therefore enforce authoritarian control of the revolution. More authoritarian love of anarchists, like on this date in 1927 when Massachusetts judge gives a death sentence to, quote, those anarchist bastards, unquote, Setco and Vassetti, which we discussed it earlier. Can you feel the love?
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, April 9th in 1947, the journey of reconciliation began, which later became the model for the famous Freedom Rides. The Journey of Reconciliation consisted of 16 men, 8 black and 8 white, who traveled in an integrated fashion by bus and train from Washington, D.C. to Louisville, Kentucky. This journey was an organized stand against the violent and racist segregationist policies of the South. It was also boldly testing a recent Supreme Court decision banning racial segregation in interstate travel. During the rides, 12 of the men were arrested, and although the NAACP had promised to represent them, they unexpectedly backed out. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
This week in radical history for April 10th, 1729 in New World. Advertisement in the American Weekly Mercury offers Indian women and children for sale.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, April 10th in 1919, revolutionary leader Emiliano Zapata was ambushed and killed after the Mexican government placed a bounty on his head. Zapata was a leader in the Mexican Revolution and general of the Liberation Army of the South. The majority of his followers were indigenous peasants, and he fought tirelessly for the redistribution of agricultural land and communal land rights for Mexico's indigenous population. Zapata drafted the Plan de Ayala, which proclaimed the Zapatista demands for land, liberty, and justice. The revolutionary Zapatista Army of National Liberation in Chiapas, Mexico, was named in Zapata's honor. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Two more items for April 10th, 1981. UN approves World Treaty assuring no civilian shall be attacked with napalm, mines, or booby traps. The U.S., of course, will veto this resolution. Last end of state in 1984. Senate condemns CIA mining of Nicaraguan harbors, the same harbors that acting President Ronald Reagan said a year ago was not being mined. This week in radical history for April 11th. 1617. Pocahontas, daughter of Native American King Powhatan, dies on a ship returning from England to Virginia. She leaves an infant son. School children are fed a romantic tale of Pocahontas' encounters with Captain John Smith. But the truth of the English settlers in Jamestown held her captive to force concessions from her father. The colonist John Rolfe married the captive Pocahontas, changed her name to Rebecca Rolfe, dressed her in English fineries, and took her to England for Queen Elizabeth's amusement.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This is your host, John Roberts. As promised, we are returning to our coverage of the annual revelatory conference on the Israeli lobby sponsored by the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs, which was held in Washington, D.C. in early March of 2018. Exposing the machinations of the lobby, especially AIPAC, and its inordinate influence over the U.S. President and Congress is crucial to exposing the distortions and lies of the lobby, which have controlled American opinion on the Israel-Palestine issue for decades. This morning we hear back-to-back presentations by Professor Virginia Tilley and UN Specialist Ian Williams. Each presentation begins with an introduction.
I'm Janet McMahon, Managing Editor of the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. And since April 5, 1982, when we published our first issue, we have been covering all the activities of AIPAC and the Greater Israel Lobby. So it's great to see such a wonderful turnout for our fifth conference on the Israel Lobby. And as you all know, there's a very strong wind outside today. And thank you for braving that wind. And it's a wind that I do think is blowing in our direction. So as a result of last century's two world wars, the majority of the world's countries committed themselves to the principle of international law, which was embodied in the United Nations. But adherence to that principle and to the institution has not been guaranteed, and in some cases has been outright undermined. Our first speaker, Dr. Virginia Tilley, is a professor of political science at Southern Illinois University. She earned her MA and PhD from the University of Wisconsin-Madison and an MA from Georgetown's Center for Contemporary Arab Studies. She has conducted research in Central America, Israel-Palestine, post-apartheid South Africa, and Oceania. She is the author of The One-State Solution, A Pragmatic Analysis of the Two-State Solution in Israel-Palestine, and editor of Beyond Occupation, Apartheid, Colonialism, and International Law in the Occupied Palestinian Territories. Dr. Tilley is also the co-author with Professor Richard Falk of a 2017 report commissioned by the UN's Economic and Social Commission for Western Asia titled Israeli Practices Towards the Palestinian People and the Question of Apartheid. Despite intense pressure from Israel and the U.S., the commission's chair, Rima Khalif, refused to withdraw the report and resigned in protest. The UN subsequently deleted the report from its website. Fortunately, however, we are about to benefit from the expertise which informed that report's findings. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Virginia Tilley.
Thank you very much. It's a distinct privilege to be here, especially in the somewhat daunting position of first speaker. I just have to set the tone. I'm not seeing my presentation quite yet. Maybe that could go on. There we go. In this presentation, I'm not actually going to talk too much about the findings of the report. We really did write that report for a broad, informed audience of concerned people, and it is not hard to read. I think you don't have to be a legal scholar to do it. So I'm going to briefly summarize the report itself and then talk about what I think is much more engaging at this point to me, which is the implications of the report, implications for diplomacy and conflict resolution in Israel-Palestine. So I was asked to address the question of, is the U.S. supporting an apartheid state in Israel-Palestine? Well, yes, it is, in short. It is an apartheid state. And by the way, there is no such thing in international law as apartheid state, but its practices are consistent with apartheid, and I'll come to that in a moment. But the deeper answer here is yes, and so are a lot of other people, including people who wouldn't think they are. And that's what I wanted to come to in regard to the implications of this finding for questions such as the two-state solution. essentially those seeking partition are endorsing an apartheid state, that is a bit startling, so I want to get to that. And it raises this dilemma that if apartheid anywhere is inadmissible and destabilizing, it cannot comprise the basis for a just and stable peace. Now, this lifts us out of a question of whether you're pro-anybody, and simply if you're concerned about international peace and security, which apartheid is considered to be a threat to. So in this talk, again, I'm going to talk briefly about the analysis, the legal definition of apartheid, how it works, and why it requires Israel to sustain the occupation. This is a particular point I'd like to bring forth here, and then move on to the implications and why it brings us directly to the question of reunification as the only viable mode of conflict resolution. So it is based on three sources. The first is my own book that I wrote narrowly on the question of whether Israel could be expected to withdraw from the occupied territories to allow a two-state solution. The second one was this really extraordinary experience of coordinating a team of international lawyers. I'm a political scientist, not an international lawyer. Through a project supported by the South African government. I believe this is on the desk out there. It is a legal analysis. Any of you who are familiar with international law should find it rewarding. Others of you might find it a bit dense. And the third one, of course, is this wonderful experience I had, a privilege of working with Dr. Richard Falk on the UN report, which was mentioned already. And a lot of what I'm going to say here came out of that report, but a lot of what's in that report relied on the previous one, Beyond Occupation. So the deeper legal analysis for the UN report is to be found there. So what is apartheid? We, very briefly, the report gets into this in detail. We use apartheid very broadly. People, anything that sort of strikes us as racist or segregationist maybe elicit this term. That's perfectly fine as far as I'm concerned. We use terms anyway that are suggestive or useful for a particular analysis. But if we're going to argue that states are accountable under international law to act to end apartheid, then we must refer to the law which prescribes that obligation. That means we are brought to the relevant international law, and that is found in two major instruments, the International Convention on the Suppression and Punishment of the Crime of Apartheid and the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. The first definition is far larger, much more detailed, but it lists a series of acts, including segregation and reserves that I'll come to. But it says that these are only acts of apartheid under certain conditions. They have to fit certain overarching conditions. And those conditions include, they may be similar to practices in South Africa. This is a universal instrument. They do not have to be exactly the same. The point is whether they seek, they have these other qualities of the law, that they are, that these are acts committed for the purpose of establishing and maintaining domination. That, I call that the purpose clause. And that it involves racial groups. That and a systematic system of oppression, that is, it is not just a random collection of discrete laws, but a comprehensive institutionalized system that distinguishes the apartheid. And the Rome Statute picks up on that by emphasizing, bringing in a new term, which is institutionalized regime. Political scientists get all flushed with pleasure when you talk about regimes because we have loads of theory about regimes. We start to feel a little bit more on familiar land. All these elements of the definition are satisfied in this case. The report, I refer you to the report on this. It is an institutionalized regime. It's a comprehensive system of laws that ensures Jewish national privileges. And I want to stress that hyphenated construction here, the idea that Jews are a nation and that as a people or a nation that they have this certain privileges, that it does include policies similar to South Africa, but any policy variation there would not disqualify them necessarily, but it's nonetheless quite suggestive that they do. It is a racial conflict according to international law, defining what is racial discrimination, which includes groups defined by descent. And in this case, the local construction of Jewishness and Palestinianness or Arabness is descent groups. The key quality here, which conveys special privileges to one group over another, is postulations about their descent and therefore their rights to the land dating from antiquity. Expressed particularly in the Declaration of the Establishment of the State of Israel, which has the status of constitutional law in Israeli law. I'm speaking kind of fast here about law, so if you're getting a little like the wind outside, it's not to worry. It's clarified in the report. And crucially, the purpose clause is satisfied, that there is this aim, this formal aim, to maintain Israel as a Jewish and democratic state. We have a cluster of laws and policies on the books to look at to confirm that Israel has that purpose, if anyone was in doubt about it. So from a legal perspective, that is satisfied as well. What was more interesting to me when figuring out how Israel was pursuing its apartheid regime was the way it works, which is these crucial policy variations among four interwoven regimes and by the domains, which domain referring here to a territorial, a geographic entity and a cluster of expectations, norms, rules, practices within that geographically defined ambit. The first domain being Palestinian citizens of Israel. Now, what matters here most is the right to vote, because if you're going to have Jewish and democratic state, then it becomes important not to allow non-Jews to vote those laws out. That means that you have to constrain the vote. You can allow people to vote, but you can't allow them to vote on that point. And in order to do that, you have to make sure that the non-Jewish vote is never large enough to threaten those laws. So Palestinian citizens of Israel famously do have the vote, which is often cited as the crucial difference with South Africa, but they are not allowed to vote against their own minority status. They are not allowed to vote against the Jewish national character of Israel. Palestinian residents of Jerusalem, about 300,000 people, have no national vote. They can vote for the municipal government, but not for the national government, so they are carefully excised from that potential body of voters who could challenge the Jewish national character of Israel. Palestinians in the occupied territories, of course, have no vote. They are not citizens. And they can vote for the Palestinian Authority under the terms of Oslo, but they are carefully sequestered. 5+ million people are carefully pushed out of any possibility of joining an electoral bloc that could challenge this state. And Domain 4 is the Palestinian refugees outside of the country, which outside of the territory under Israeli control, which is clearly, obviously, they don't have the vote. So another way to think of this is as a system, one regime that is effectively composed of four tailored sets of laws covering each population to achieve the same goal, which is to ensure that Israel remains a Jewish and democratic state. All kinds of arguments about whether you can be a Jewish and democratic state or a white and democratic state, I recognize that, but we don't have time to get into that now. What I would like to stress here is that this system requires that Israel maintain the occupation. Because if Israel does not keep the occupied territories under belligerent occupation, under military occupation, it faces the twin threat that a truly sovereign Palestinian state could form in those territories, which would then threaten Israel's capacity to prevent population mixing. Population mixing is the death knell for any racial state because the neat division of populations begins to go away. And when you have people mixing, they make babies and it all falls. No. On the other hand, annexation or full integration would require providing citizenship to the Palestinians, so that cannot be allowed either. Current talk about annexation is reflecting that dilemma, but it's better for Israel not to annex it. So what is the solution? Well, military occupation. So people who say, well, we have to solve, we must put apartheid to one side in order to look at the occupation. I think you have that the other way around. One is the logic of occupation is following the logic of apartheid. So speeding right along, part two, implications for diplomacy. If apartheid, as it always does, it destabilizes the whole region, threatens international peace and security, it must be stopped on those grounds alone. It is morally untenable. It's a crime against humanity. It must be stopped. But how? The vision of two states is fatally flawed. My first book on the one-state solution got into this in some detail. Just from a pragmatic point of view, I really only addressed that one thing. But it does mean that we cannot anticipate that Israel will withdraw. That it's become emperor's new clothes kind of fantasy to think that that will happen. I don't think that's acceptable anymore. It requires a great deal of defense, and it fails. Sustaining Jewish statehood on the part of the territory. This is the crucial thing. If you partition the land in order to allow Israel to remain Israel in one part of it and a Palestinian state to form in the other part of it, you are basically saying apartheid will continue in that part where Israel is now composed. Saying Israel will continue to be a Jewish and democratic state, will continue to operate the way it is operating, will continue to be apartheid regime in a slightly different, modified border, within different borders. Now, let's my thought experiment, transplant that I did in South Africa. It would have been okay for white South Africans to sustain apartheid in part of the country and turn over the rest of it to black South Africans. No one entertained such an idea. It was anathema. This is the same thing here. You can't end apartheid by dividing the land and allowing it to continue in another part of the land. There's other aspects of this, but cutting to the chase, I would propose, therefore, that reunification is the only way to end apartheid. And since there's so many reasons to do that, we have to take that very seriously. For activism, and by activism I mean every kind of activism from grassroots to legal activism and diplomatic activity and so forth, if you're going to, and I just wanted to focus again on this angle of end the occupation. End the occupation is a mantra, it's a slogan, it's a sign people carry in marches, it's also a legal argument. But how? Again, Israel's withdrawal from the OPT cannot be anticipated. At best, it would be very partial. This is the Olmert plan, by the way, that you're looking at up here, where all the yellow would be Israel and the white would be Palestine, with a little umbilicus between the West Bank and Gaza. I mean, this is obviously an unviable state building. You couldn't control water. You couldn't control agriculture. You can't build a road that connects it. You can't, you know, it's unworkable. Would not end apartheid. Establish a state of Palestine to leverage withdrawal. Now, this is a very popular movement right now, big diplomatic push in the United Nations to do this. However, my point here is that if we accept the apartheid analysis that this is an apartheid regime, then such a state would be a Bantustan. It would lack the attributions of true sovereignty. Israel, as long as it is composed as an apartheid regime, cannot accept any Palestinian state that is not a Bantustan, because any truly sovereign state would threaten the Jewish national character of Israel. This means that a Bantustan state, a state of Palestine formed under these conditions, would only secure Palestinian poverty, underdevelopment, frustration, insecurity, and essentially sustain the conflict itself. I'd like to just take an extra moment here, and I'm going to destroy my time constraint, I hope not, but I will pray. that a little bit of extra attention to the Bantustans is worthwhile, and I frankly encourage everyone here to Google that and spend 15 minutes looking at the Bantustans a bit more than we sometimes do. I went to South Africa to study this material because I realized I didn't understand it, and I found it fascinating as a comparison to the Palestinian Authority and the territorial and institutional constraints that it's operating under. Let's just think through the logic. Apartheid imperative. The imperative of apartheid, wherever it would appear, would be to prevent racial mixing. Okay, otherwise, the whole logic begins to fall apart. If you can't discreetly have different populations, there's nothing to defend. In order to do that, you need strict geographic segregation. This requires that you, if you're going to actually make this work, you need separate authorities within these territories. The South Africans, interestingly, called them black self-government authorities. And guess what Oslo called them? Palestinian self-government authority. It's a great deal of conversations between Israel and South Africa about the Bantustans. It took a lot of lessons from it. I learned that from the diplomats in South Africa, by the way. This channels Palestinian or black or indigenous political aspirations to the local authority rather than to the state, to the dominant state. It's very convenient for an apartheid state to displace the frustrations and ambitions and the quest for rights of the population is dominating to their own leadership operating under very tight constraints, of course. The pictures you're looking at on the top is a lineup of the Bantustan leaders in South Africa in the Bantustans, but nine of these leaders were in this picture. And below the Palestinian Authority. And by the way, I don't mean to impugn the integrity or political will of any of the Palestinian Authority people. My point here is a structural one, that they are put into a position where they are compelled to act like a Bantustan authority. Point of view of the dominant state, the main function of this authority is to repress dissent, which in the top picture you see the Bantustan armed forces, in the lower part you see the Palestinian armed forces doing exactly that, maintaining the Bantustan through proxy measures. I think the battery's giving out on this thing because I'm pushing and... Well... Let's see what happens now. Bing. There we go. All right. The Oslo Accords, we don't have time to get into this. I wrote a separate article about this, though, because I found it fascinating. The Oslo Accords established the Palestinian Authority on terms almost identical to the South African Bantustan constitutions, blow by blow. If you put those next to each other, you find almost exactly the same arrangements. And it's interesting that the ANC perceived this as a trap, rejected it from the beginning, and refused to have anything to do with it. And, in fact, I understand Nelson Mandela told Arafat, bad idea, don't go for this, this is not a good idea, and they went for it anyway. That wasn't supposed to happen. A little tricky device here. So, in short, the PIA is now locked into being this self-government authority, and it cannot act independently of that role. The alternative, therefore, is if the partition can only sustain apartheid, then we must rethink the conflict on using South Africa not as a model but as inspiration or kind of a thought experiment. They called it colonialism of a special type. It doesn't involve agreeing and admitting that a large population of people has come in and indigenized, settled, is not going to go away. Call it settler colonialism. Shift the model from a colonial to a settler colonial model. And that means that you do not end it by partition or you can't end settler colonialism and its power by partition. You have to end it by eliminating settler domination. Treating Palestine as a multinational state is, on the basis of race, would only perpetuate a settler discourse. Because it is Zionism that has proposed that there are these identities that then if you recognize them and institutionalize them, you're essentially perpetuating apartheid. Treat the whole country as one country, Palestine, wrongly divided by race. This was the South Africa formula. It's one country wrongly divided by race. This means reunifying mandate Palestine. I'm out of time, aren't I? How am I doing? Okay. There is a legal basis for doing this. If we turn back to the League of Nations mandate, it always proposed that it was one country for everyone who lived there, that it would not be a Jewish state or anybody's state. It would be a secular democratic state. So there's a nice, fat legal argument to explore there. The hard part of this is that reunification does raise very serious questions of identity shifts to reconstruct the idea of the nation, reconstruct the idea of the groups. In this case, Palestine would stop being a foggy mandate reference or a dreamy future, but it would be one state that belongs to all who live in it. It would not be the exclusive geographic heritage of any one part of the population. It would not require the departure or exclusion of anybody, which is tough for people who have lost a great deal to it. Jewish has to be reconceived as an ethnic group with full civil, social, and cultural rights, not a people with superior rights to the land, not as a nation with rights to self-determination. And Palestinian, this is the toughest thing for me to say as a non-Palestinian, but it returning to the idea that it is a multi-sectarian identity, it still is, actually, embracing everyone in mandate territory, not Arab in any sense that would exclude non-Arabs. Okay, this is one of the problems that Palestinian became Palestinian-Arab state. And under conditions of settler colonialism, you can't do that without excluding non-Arabs, and therefore, unfortunately, that has to be rethought deeply. Not the racial ethnic construction affirmed by Zionism and imposed by apartheid. So that's why the apartheid finding recasts everything. That's why so many people don't want to tackle it. I think it is crucial. I think it illuminates where we are and what is going on, and the more I look at it, the more powerful an analysis I think it is, and I do hope you will consider it seriously as a model for rethinking the conflict. Thank you very much.
Our next speaker, Ian Williams, is a native of Liverpool, England, and has been the Washington Report's UN correspondent since 1991. So it's no surprise that he really knows the ins and outs of that world body. He has twice served as president of the UN Correspondents Association and has won many awards for his exposés of UN malfeasance. At the same time, he has supported and defended the UN and its ideals and has personally known four secretaries general, as well as numerous international diplomats and officials. Ian has been a columnist for The Nation and The Guardian American Online and an editor for the World Policy Journal. A senior analyst for Foreign Policy in Focus, he is the author of The UN for Beginners and the recently published Untold, The Real Story of the United Nations in Peace and War. And he and Dr. Tilley will be signing their books during the break that follows this panel. Please join me in welcoming Ian Williams.
It'd be difficult to follow Virginia's detailed academic expose, but it's worth remembering, you know, one of the big problems with the United Nations is people, what's it good for? And, you know, I'm very diffident about this. I tell people it's the worst possible organization except all the alternatives. And it does work that way. If you start off with a sense of realism about what the United Nations can do, what it stands for, then you don't get disappointed too easily, and you welcome its small successes. And there are successes, and they're very relevant here. And there's a very good reason why Israel and its lobby concentrate so much on the United Nations. What Kofi Annan called the unique legitimizing power of the United Nations. We've seen several results of this recently. And Israel can never get clear title of Jerusalem or the occupied territories without a UN say-so. That's key. And it's actually been proven since 1945. If you think of the occupations, East Timor, everyone had given up on East Timor. The Indonesians, I actually told the foreign minister over lunch one day, you'll never get clear title, ever, until you can get the UN to do it, and the UN won't. So they fought it to a standstill in there, but in the end, East Timor is independent. Only this week, and I don't know whether you saw this, the European Court of Justice actually ruled that the European Union had no right to sign fishing treaties with Morocco that included Western Saharan fisheries. In effect, the European Court was legitimizing boycotts of produce from occupied territories. I think that one is something that should be played up a lot more. Yeah, because I know it's a contentious subject, but we've pointed out several times in Washington Report that there's a separation wall in Western Sahara as well as in Palestine, that there are many parallels there. The other one, of course, is Western Sahara will, in fact, sometime, even you never see a map where it's included in Morocco. The Moroccans cannot get clear title, and it's the same with the occupied territories and Jerusalem. And this brings us back to the ambivalence of Israel and the lobby. They have, how should I put this? It's almost psychological, psychoanalysis. They have a deep respect for law. But in a sort of the Talmudic way that makes the elevator stop on every floor in the Sabbath so they can still take the elevator and obey the letter. Israel spends a lot of time trying to work its way around the laws. It very rarely completely denies them. So at the United Nations, they and the U.S. spend a lot of time trying to create the sort of Sabbath elevator so that they can skirt within the law. But they are very scared of actual definitions of the law. That's why they are so upset. If the U.N. were ineffectual, they wouldn't devote so much effort to thwarting resolutions in there. And take Virginia's object. There is an apartheid convention. And it's like the genocide convention. There is a legal international binding commitment on member states to do something about an apartheid state. If Israel is declared to be an apartheid state or be practicing apartheid, there are legal consequences that states have to follow. In another regard, if you remember Jim Baker in Bosnia and the State Department were very, very solicitous to make sure the word genocide never appeared. You know, mass murder was fine. Mass murder is something that you can ignore. Genocide has a binding legal commitment under the Genocide Convention. You have to do something about it. So, you know, it looks like we're playing with words, but this is very, very serious. And the Israelis know that. For a start, they deny it, but in effect, Israel is the only state that was actually created by a UN resolution. So you have the conundrum that they have been busily denying the efficacy of the United Nations, its legitimacy, saying that the resolutions don't apply. But their very existence depends on a resolution. You hear continually a theme that General Assembly resolutions aren't binding. And we could say, amen, because it was a General Assembly resolution that partitioned Palestine and set up the Israeli state. So you can see you could have a whole joint conclave of Jesuits and Talmud scholars to work your way out of this particular fine print, you know, where you're denying the basis for your own existence. And it does have international complications because the United States was a founding member of the United Nations. It's still an indispensable part of the United Nations. It's inconceivable that the United Nations would exist without the United States taking part in it. And this creates severe problems because there's always the Israeli exception. Almost every law that comes, every resolution that comes up is being weighed in the balance. Nuclear non-proliferation, we saw with Grant's presentation earlier. the United States is signatory to non-proliferation treaties that say that no country apart from the five permanent members should have nuclear weapons. And then it condones nuclear weapons in Israel. And because it does that, every other country in the world, India, Pakistan, North Korea, say, hey, if them, why not us? You're continually creating exceptions to your own rules that other people walk in through. You know, the settlements in particular, the U.S. has never actually approved them, but they've changed the language so often over the years that it's as far as the U.S. is concerned, Jerusalem is international territory, the State Department. I believe, just showing this punctiliousness about law, I think I read earlier this year that the State Department is still refusing to issue passports with Jerusalem, Israel, to Americans born there. It's still Jerusalem. They won't put Israel on there. So the State Department does have some residual respect for international law that's missing from the White House completely. So let's get these territories together, because the UN is like... the UN is a sort of cockpit for all of these things. All human life is there. You're watching it. And you have this ambivalent attitude. Is most American Jews, as we know, are liberal globalists. They support democracy and freedom. They like the United Nations. They made an exception because of all this stuff about Israel and Zionism as racism. They didn't think it through, but, you know, it eroded the support. And this helped erode the support for the United Nations inside the U.S. You got the people who would automatically have been natural supporters of the UN were always ambivalent about it. You have Jewish senators from New York looking over their shoulders who will pass resolutions condemning the UN, cutting the funds. And that's one of the points that the lobby has been doing in Washington, is to try to trim the UN to size by threatening to withhold funds, or actually withholding funds, or pulling out of organizations, as we've seen recently. And the effect of this isn't just financial. It is a continual sort of attrition of the morale and standing in the UN. We've seen secretary generals now who realize that to get on with the US, you have to pander to the Israel lobby. And all secretary generals have done this to some extent in a pragmatic political way. Kofi Annan was possibly the most accommodating up till then. Ban Ki-moon had a continual stream of the Jewish lobby organizations, B'nai B'rith, Conference of Presidents, that they were coming into his office all of the time. He always received them. They were banging on the door. They were also in the UN, and they were banging on the doors of embassies. All of these funny swing states that you sort of, the micro states that only stamp collectors know about usually, will come up to support the US and Israel on these crucial resolutions. You know, the 2, 3, 6, the Pacific Trust territories, a few others, they come there. And this is a result of intensive lobbying by the Israel lobby here on these states to affect Israeli policy. At the moment, we have a particular situation coming, it would be almost laughable, except it's so serious. I don't know whether you know, but Israel is actually running for a seat on the Security Council this year. And, you know, on the face of it, this is laughable, but we have to remember that Morocco was on the Security Council while occupying Western Sahara. Indonesia was on the Security Council while it was occupying East Timor. Rwanda was on the Security Council while it was massacring its own population. You know, so it's not totally unprecedented. But usually they didn't actually say they're defying the whole gamut of international law openly. And is this likely to happen? I don't know. I don't want to get too much into it. But they're running for seat in the West European and Other group, which is an imperial sort of hangover, because essentially it is Europe plus the white Commonwealth, Australia, New Zealand and Canada, plus the US as a sort of ancillary member. And the Asians wouldn't have them. The Africans wouldn't have them. So in the end, intense lobbying by the lobby through the US came in and badgered the Europeans into accepting Israel as a sort of associate member so it could run for offices, which run on a rotatory basis. So Israel became a vice president of the General Assembly, became chairman of obscure committees. Would you believe the Israeli ambassador, I think, is chairman of the legal subcommittee at the moment? Which is, it's like putting Casanova in charge of the chastity committee. Does not compute. But this Israeli ambassador is actually very, very concerned about this bid. Then this was upgraded very quietly so that Israel became a full member. So it was allowed to run for this, it could run for the Security Council. And the mechanics of this is, regrettably, I mean, it's good for Western Europe, but most of the countries, the Security Council seats rotate on a Bugginstern basis. You know, they have calendars going decades ahead sometimes of who occupies what position at the UN, which is why you get genocides in the Human Rights Committee, and now you might get Israel on the Security Council. And the reason for that is, West Europe is the only one that actually has elections. And if they don't decide within their own group, then it goes to a general poll of all the members to who becomes a temporary member of the Security Council. So Germany and Belgium are the current candidates, and Israel is running against them. And I've been trying to sort of calculate the odds on this. It's difficult. I can imagine there are Israeli ambassadors, there are Israeli diplomats going into Berlin and saying, you owe us so much. Why don't you do the right thing? Why don't you stand down and let us run? How could you deny us? Do you want to compound your crimes? And the Germans will say, well, we'll give you another submarine. Shut up. We're taking this one, I suspect. But I am worried about Belgium. The other people will gang up on Belgium and say, you should stand down and do the right thing. Because that's the only way to get in. If it goes to an open poll, Israel isn't going to get it. But if it's done with a stitch-up like this, if Belgium is leaned upon sufficiently by the other powers, it might just do it. So it's worth watching and it's worth intervening. What's the practical effect? A lot. You know, discussions in the Security Council, they do end up crucial. The resolutions that come through, even a temporary member in there can have considerable effect. You know, while France was grandstanding over the Iraq War, it was the other smaller countries with the respect for international law, like Jamaica and Ireland and others like that, who actually provided the bulk of the opposition to the Iraq War in there and stood their ground. Where do we get to with this ambassador? And I think this is where it brings the lobby in as well. Because the UN is so unpopular in some parts of America, like the evangelical Christians, or with the diehard Zionists, it's a great fundraising gamut. I keep getting letters from various organizations saying, poor little Israel, the only country not allowed to be on the Security Council. Poor little Israel, continually victimized at the United Nations, send a check. And I think it's one of the dynamics, I think Grant touched on it before, is these organizations are businesses. They're self-sustaining businesses, so they want checks off people. And if they can find an issue at the United Nations, they can raise money on the strength of it, and they do. But then it has a practical effect, because secretary generals, UN staff get pilloried, they get harassed to do the right thing. And we've seen that with the reports that have been squashed. You know, they'll just get dropped, or they'll be sidelined. I mean, look what happened to poor Arthur Goldstone. Now, he was personally harried into the ground until he gave up. I felt he was almost a tragic figure by the end, because he started off with such integrity. But with the US, it's even worse, because it destroys the whole basis of the United Nations. The embassy move is in direct defiance of the UN Charter. The US, the founder and drafter of the UN Charter. When the UN Charter was flown from San Francisco to Washington, the case had its own parachute. Alger Hiss, who was carrying the case, didn't have a parachute. I think maybe they knew something or suspected something. But, I mean, that was how seriously the US took the UN at the time. And this is setting at naught international law. I mean, it's being defied, but this is the significance of it. Donald Trump has basically ripped up the UN Charter. And then it getting, because we're talking about people who can believe three impossible things before breakfast, like the Red Queen in Alice, they are now saying, but Iran is in defiance of UN resolutions. Therefore, we must take action against it. Because that's the other fulcrum at the moment. The case for a war against Iran is being made in the United Nations. Our current ambassador, Nikki Haley, there, she should get her credentials from Tel Aviv. Not Jerusalem. Because I've never heard her say anything that isn't 150% in support of Israel. She really is. She's devoted her full time there, and she gets there and pledges in. It gets down to the actual reason why the lobby is so important for these people. You want power in Washington, it goes through the lobby. You want to be president in the United States, as the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. most assuredly does, you go through the lobby. They will jump through any hoops at all to do it. And that risks they risk the organization, which, for all its faults, it's a major but pragmatic conclusion. You may look at the UN and say it's a failure, but as people in there will tell you, we haven't had World War III yet. And that's the measure. But this is the road to World War III. If you dissolve the whole structure of international global law and security, that's where we're going. And that's what Donald Trump has started, and he's done it on behalf of the lobby in there. He's done it because all across this country, people are writing checks to congressmen, persuading them to vote in defiance of international law and to vote to revile the United Nations. There are refugees who will be going very, very hungry all across the Middle East soon because Donald Trump has defunded UNRWA, which, by the way, has been doing the Israelis a favor. They've been very ambivalent. They like to revile it to keep it off balance. But you have to remember that UNRWA has been doing what Israel should have been doing as the occupying power. UNRWA has been paying for the health and education of occupied Palestinians when the occupying power should have been doing it under the Geneva Convention. So the Israelis have known this all along, and they've reviled and shouted about UNRWA, but only so far. I think they are privately probably appalled that Trump has actually followed through on their bluff and cut the funding. No, we didn't mean it, Mr. President. We want the money, honestly. We just want to keep them under control. So they have kept them under control to a large extent. They've kept Secretary General after Secretary General under control to some extent. But it still comes back to it. Ban Ki-moon had all of these people from all of the Israeli organizations coming in. But he always, once he'd been to Gaza and saw what was happening in Gaza, that was the key. The Israelis tried to stop him going to Gaza. As soon as he got there, you see all of his statements, he stated very clearly the UN positions about occupation, about Gaza. And so, yes, he kept receiving them, but then he would tell them, you've got to break the siege. You cannot keep on doing this. You've got to end the occupation. And Guterres is in the same position. He's instinctively pro-Israeli, like a lot of European social democrats. But he is now telling them, gently, you've got to. But the terrible thing is, as long as the US is 100% behind Israel, and as long as the lobby keeps it that way, then the UN is never going to be a functioning international body in a complete way, which is bad news for the world, all of us, on every level. Whether it's climate change or whatever. It is an indispensable organization, and I see I've entered the red light district now. So I'd better wind up. I always stay in the red light district if I can, but I'll go and sit down. Thank you very much.
I'm Robin Upton. And this week's title, Unlawful Killing, is the title of a film that I'm going to be adapting. Before we go any further, if you're a radio producer and you're not on the mailing list for those who air the show locally, then you may not have gathered. This is a radio adaptation of a film that has been effectively more or less banned in the UK and the US. Now, I know nothing about the legal issues of running a local radio station, except removing what the FCC terms as indecent language. I have done that on this film. It contains no expletives that, to my knowledge, will arouse the ill will of the FCC, and I'm certainly not intending to offend anybody's sensibilities by my choice of material. Now, I don't know on what basis it's deemed to be acceptable to prevent people from stating their opinions because they contravene other people's deeply held beliefs, but the makers of this film state at one point that they were advised of 87 legal issues concerning the film. Now, these legal issues have hitherto prevented the film being broadcast widely in the UK or the US. Well, it was that ban that originally attracted me to the film, because I thought, well, if it's full of nonsense, then they're not going to mind it being aired. So I thought, what information does this film have that the establishment particularly seeks to hide? As a result, I've been particularly scrupulous as far as checking out the references. And with the one exception that I cite on the show's description page, that's unwelcomeguest.net/680, then pretty much everything I checked out was easily verifiable. People do seem to agree, for example, that there is a handwritten note by Diana to her butler that Prince Charles was planning a road accident to remove her. They do agree that she said the same thing to her lawyer, who made a note of it the following day, that this note, after the accident, was submitted to the police as evidence, and that it was handed up the chain of command, came into the possession of the chief policeman in the UK, the head of the UK Metropolitan Police, that, rather than disclose this information, he chose to sit on it for a few years, and in so doing, laying himself open to a charge of concealing evidence. Well, has that person been brought to justice? A courageous French lawyer has actually picked up the case, long after it had been put to bed by the official UK establishment. Gérard Cadéo was trying to get to the bottom of why the Michcon note was kept secret, who ordered this, and whether any criminal charges should result from it. So as recently as 2012, Lord Condon went and gave evidence about why he hadn't disclosed the note. Now, as the name reveals, far from being judged worthy of censure, Lord Condon was judged by the UK establishment to be the sort of material who should be sitting in the House of Lords for the end of his days, making the laws, so was awarded a life peerage. The sort of thing to make me wonder just how many other life peers are sitting in the House of Lords after a similar chain of circumstances. Anyway, the 2011 film was funded by Mohamed Al-Fayed, father of Diana's fiancé, who was killed with her in the same crash. Now, the film has numerous courtroom reconstructions, which are labelled as such, so when you hear a date and a time, then, although it's taken from original notes, so I think the quotes are verbatim what was said, the recordings are not. So the establishment, as we touched on before, doesn't seem to want cameras in the courts of justice, as if justice was something that was better served up in secret. I am sitting here at my desk today in October, longing for someone to hug me and encourage me to keep strong and hold my head high. This particular phrase in my life is the most dangerous. My husband is planning an accident in my car. Brake failure and serious head injury, in order to make the path clear for him to marry Tiggy. Camilla is nothing but a decoy, so we are all being used by the man in every sense of the word. I have been battered, bruised, and abused mentally by a system for 15 years now, but I feel no resentment, I carry no hatred. I am weary of the battles, but I will never surrender. I am strong inside, and maybe that is a problem for my enemies. Unlawful Killing, a film by Keith Allen.
In 1997, the death of a princess and her lover rocked the world. 10 years later, it led to the longest, most expensive, and most sensational inquest in British legal history. Hundreds of witnesses were called. There were arguments, lies, tears, and accusations. as intimate details of their private lives were dissected on the world stage. Yet before the court case had even begun, the media had already decided what the verdict should be. However, in Britain and around the world, millions of ordinary people were convinced, and after the inquest still are convinced, that the deaths of Princess Diana and Dodi Fayed were no accident. I wasn't sure if Diana's death was an accident or murder, but I suspected a cover-up by the British establishment, an elaborate exercise in burying the truth rather than uncovering it. I suspected a conspiracy, but this isn't just the old story about a conspiracy before the crash, it's about a conspiracy after the crash.
Professor Laurie Taylor, sociologist.
We all know that the biggest scandals are always the cover-ups. I mean, it isn't the Watergate, it's not the break-in, it's the cover-up which is the big scandal.
Piers Morgan, journalist and television presenter.
When you have the head of the British Security Services calmly announcing we have never killed anybody in the last 50 years, I laughed out loud. What's the point of them then? I didn't believe it. And so if you don't believe that, where does that leave the rest of the establishment evidence?
I decided to watch and wait, then tell the story that the press and TV news wouldn't tell. The result is a documentary that reveals what really happened during those 6 months in the Royal Courts of Justice. It is The Inquest of the Inquest. The royal family likes to present itself as part of a benign and freedom-loving tradition in films such as The King's Speech. As you will have gathered by now, this film is the antidote to The King's Speech. The inquest was held in the royal family's own court, so is it any wonder that the coroner, the royal representative in charge, decided that the key royal suspects need not even appear at the inquest to be questioned?
Richard Wiseman, our undercover reporter.
Right from the inquest's first day, I thought, what if this woman's name had been Diana Smith, and she'd written in a note which had been subsequently unveiled, "My husband Charles Smith wants me to die in a car accident." And subsequently she did. In any other family or in any other country, surely Charles Smith would have been called to the witness stand at the inquest into his wife's death.
Every word you hear from the courtroom has been meticulously reconstructed just as it happened. I also had my own undercover reporter in the press tent, Richard Wiseman, listening to the journalists' conversations. Every word you hear them say was noted down exactly and precisely timed and dated.
I thought when we started that I had about a fortnight before somebody tripped over my notes and realised that I actually wasn't making notes on the inquest, I was making notes on what the other journalists were saying to each other. And the longer it went on, the more I thought, I can't believe I'm getting away with this.
For once, a reporter was doing the dirty on his colleagues, so the world could learn how they only reported one side of the story, ignoring anything that didn't fit their pre-written script.
This looks like 6 months of my life not going to get back.
Day one, 3:45 p.m.
Absolute nightmare, isn't it? There's a road accident, for Christ's sake, get over it.
Oliver James, clinical psychologist.
Young girls identify with the person who becomes the consort of the king. The big idea of being a princess and becoming queen is a fantasy. There are fairy stories about it. It's a constant fantasy for little girls.
Diana dreamed of becoming a princess too. But unfortunately for her, when her fairy tale fantasy came true, the reality was not a dream. It was a nightmare.
The royal family, it really is true, are much more, at least in that generation, are much more interested in animals than they are in human beings.
The royals are not a sentimental bunch and treat their wives like farmers treat cattle. They're not big on romance. They're very big on breeding.
And I suppose in love.
Of course.
Whatever in love means.
Whatever in love means. Perhaps that was Diana's first intimation that this would be a loveless marriage.
First of all, Mr. Al-Fayed, you have been saying for years that you believe your son was not the victim of an accident, that when he was with Lady Di, the royal family was so upset with her dating him. The fact that he was Muslim, they had him bumped off. Definitely. In other words, this was a hit, a murder, and not an accident.
Mohammed Al-Fayed, billionaire Egyptian business magnate and sponsor of this film.
Absolutely. He's a terrorist murderer.
Okay.
It's not a murder, it's a slaughter of those bloody racist royal family.
You think Prince Philip is so smart that he can mastermind all of this and orchestrate it?
Yeah, he's vicious. Of course, you think a guy like that would accept? My son, different religion, different nationality, will be the future stepfather of the future king. You think this bloody racist family, right, will accept that?
I feel for you. If my daughters were in that car with Lady Di, and this was,
of course you'd want to get to the bottom of it.
I'd want to get to the bottom of it, and I don't blame you. Mr. Al-Fayed, just as a background, are you a self-made guy? I mean, did you just come to...
That's right. That's self-made.
Brian Basham, writer.
I think the whole bloody thing's racist. I think that Mohammed, from the day that he came here and had the temerity to bid for the top people's stall, has been considered to be some sort of a wog, nigger, if you like, who has sort of thrust himself on British society.
Born in Alexandria under British colonial rule, Mohammed quickly left behind his humble Egyptian origins, making a fortune as a middleman for British firms in the Middle East, and whilst doing so, becoming a global billionaire. Proving that it's not where you come from that matters, it's where you end up. And he's ended up in a very nice place indeed.
Besides having owned Harrods for 25 years, Mohammed Al-Fayed owns the Paris Ritz, a villa in Saint-Tropez, a Scottish castle, and a Tudor mansion on the edge of London. But he chooses to spend much of his time in this tent so he can be close to the burial place of his son, Dodi. He remembers the night of the tragedy all too clearly.
Straight away, going to the mortuary to see Dodi, you know. It was a terrible scene, you know, it was so difficult. And everything worked in my mind, that's definitely there. They killed him. Yeah, and this is the place which he basically lived most of the time. He liked to play polo. This is the whole field which I planted as a forest. I come sometime here, I have breakfast. I sit with him because we believe soul comes out, you know. Maybe he's watching, his soul watching us, you know, and talking to us. It's difficult.
The crash happened on the 31st of August 1997, the last day of an extraordinary month for Diana. There was the whirlwind romance with Dodi, fevered speculation in the press that she was about to get married, even that she might be pregnant. Where would it all end? Would the mother of the future King of England get hitched to a Muslim and have children by him too and set up a rival court in the USA?
The princess of the world at that time. The girl everybody wanted. I saw him with her. I saw the house in Malibu that Dodi was going to buy for them.
Who knows what might have happened if she'd lived. So whether you think it was an accident or murder, one fact is incontrovertibly true. It was chillingly convenient for the Windsors that Diana died when she did.
The last holiday she spent with her boys, with me for nearly 2 weeks, she was worried and she told me exactly what was going to happen to her.
So she definitely rocked the boat in an extraordinary fashion, and she's still rocking it.
She won't go quietly, that's the problem. I'll fight till the end.
It's day one of the inquest into Diane and Dodi's deaths. Some say the cause was a drunken driver called Henri Paul. Some blame the paparazzi. Others suspect foul play, a staged crash involving a mysterious white Fiat Uno, perhaps on the orders of Prince Philip. The French report into the crash has been kept secret. The British report was riddled with contradictions. Several coroners came and went, and attempts to hold the inquest without a jury were overturned. So here we are, at last, at the start of an inquest that may finally turn the full floodlights onto the workings of the British establishment and the royal family. The media call this the Diana Inquest, forgetting that three people died in that crash, not just Diana, but Dodi Fayed and driver Henri Paul too. Apparently there is a meritocracy even in death, and some demises are considered more important than others. That's me.
Keith Allen, outside the Royal Courts of Justice. Note that name, Royal Courts of Justice. A sure sign of impartiality in a case where the credibility of the royal family is on trial. In the Royal Courts of Justice with a judge, or coroner, as he's called here, who has sworn an oath of allegiance to the Queen and his Queen's counsellors on every side, and has already said that he is minded not to call senior royals as witnesses.
That's Lord Justice Scott Baker. Stephen Hassler, Professor of Government.
Historically, the relationship between the royal family and courts has been difficult, mainly because every judge has taken an oath of allegiance to the Queen. Now, if you've taken an oath of allegiance to the Queen and you have a legal case involving the monarchy, I mean, you're going to be biased, aren't you?
Curiously, the media have decided the outcome of the inquest before it has even begun and have already declared it a waste of time and money. Many media organisations, including the BBC, have even sent their royal reporters to cover it rather than their legal reporters.
Our royal correspondent Nicholas Witchell is at the High Court. Nick.
Yet Diana was no longer royal at the time of her death, and BBC royal reporters are required to spend their lives shamelessly sucking up to the palace and presenting the Windsors to the public in a favourable light. So what chance is there of impartiality from them? With most people getting their news about the inquest from journalists with such an obvious bias, I thought it was important that somebody with an open mind also reported on it. Quis custodiet ipsos custodes? Who judges the judges? Well, on this occasion, it seemed to be me and my mole. From the outset, it was clear that the coroner was firmly on the side of the establishment, hardly surprising, as he's part of it.
I thought the story of the opening day would be the coroner points the jury in the direction of it being an accident, which he clearly did, and also the fact he was anticipating what the former leader of the London police was going to say without him being there.
Day two, 11:14 a.m.
I anticipate that Lord Stevens will give evidence that he was trying to reassure the Pauls that their son had not been as drunk as a pig as had been alleged in some newspapers.
Seems to me that the establishment have been talking to each other and squaring their stories before the inquest gets underway. Why aren't the media suspicious?
This is really fishy. There's something very odd going on around here. And what makes it all the more odd is that the juiciest bits, the bits that are striking me as being the murkiest of all, aren't being reported anywhere. And it wasn't so much that there was a conspiracy amongst other journalists, that there was an established consensus. And anyone who sort of thought or spoke or wrote outside that consensus were regarded as being odd.
Professor Laurie Taylor, sociologist.
This has interesting echoes of The Merchant of Venice. Because if we go back to The Merchant of Venice, I mean, the fundamental point is about Shylock, he's different. He's Jewish in this case, but also Oriental.
Despite what I remember being told at school, Shakespeare's Shylock wasn't actually a bad character at all. He was just a foreigner who wanted justice, but was swindled out of it by the Venetian establishment.
Here's Fayed, the Oriental, going and saying, by the way, I want a fair trial. And they're saying, well, no, just a minute, you know, it's all over. I mean, don't bother about it. Don't be serious. It was an accident. You know, we didn't really mean it. No, he said, I'm coming into court. I'm going to use your judicial system against you. And, of course, he's robbed in court. When you read that, you can also read it as an essay in the way in which the establishment, the Venetian establishment, suddenly find themselves confronted by an outsider who's demanding his rights. He's saying, all I want is justice. Can I have justice, please? You set up all this judicial system. I'd like it, please. And they want to really say, well, it's not for you, you bastard.
The point of the inquest is to investigate these suspicious circumstances surrounding the crash. But will it answer these questions? Was it pure coincidence that Diana told many people she would be deliberately killed in a car crash? Why did the CCTV cameras along the route apparently not record anything? Were driver Henri Paul's blood samples tampered with to make him appear wildly drunk, even though he seemed to be sober? Why were Diana's phone calls being bugged by the American Secret Services? And who was driving the white Fiat Uno that may have caused the crash? Poor Diana. All the royals wanted was a brood mare crossed with a clothes horse. Life did indeed go on for a little bitty while, until the brood mare turned out to be a kicker who bolted through the stable door and went to get her oats elsewhere.
Noel Botham, author of The Murder of Princess Diana.
The establishment didn't want the idea of a future king of England having a Muslim half-brother or sister.
There's only one conspiracy theory, as far as I'm concerned, to do the death of Diana, and that is a conspiracy that's grown up that it was an accident.
Day 3, 2:33 p.m.
Before a single witness had been called.
I think the remaining thing that needs to be done is the jury bailiffs need to be sworn for the journey to Paris. See you in Paris.
This is where the jury will gather to retrace Diana and Dodie's final journey. We'll have to be careful not to film the jury, because we could be sent to prison for contempt if we show their faces, even though anyone who bothers to come here can see perfectly well who they are.
Hotel Ritz, Place Vendôme.
And, oh, look. Oh, there's Posh Spice, who just happens to walk out of the Ritz while the world's cameras are here. Diana was a celebrity who was supposedly hounded by the paparazzi, yep. Now here's another celebrity using the inquest as a chance for a photo opportunity with the paparazzi. They never learn. Ah, there's the legal charabang. This bus is officially a courtroom, we've been told, and must be treated with the same dignity as the royal courts of justice themselves. But, oh dear, first it appears to have knocked a policeman off his motorcycle and now a tyre has just burst, thereby somehow undermining the majesty of the law. After the jury had visited the crash scene, so did I.
This step.
Where?
Here.
This is it?
Yeah.
Is this the tunnel?
Yeah, you didn't know?
No.
As well as endlessly debating whether Dodie might have impregnated Diana, the inquest devoted several weeks to a minute investigation of her periods, contraceptives and sexual habits. It's almost as though the establishment wanted to demythologize her in the eyes of ordinary people by putting her uterus on public display.
Piers Morgan, journalist and television presenter.
And by going in with Dodie Fayed and falling in love with him, as I believe she absolutely did, head over heels with the guy, you've got the ultimate cocktail of danger for the British establishment.
Perhaps it was unwise for Diana and Dodie to get together, but they clearly fell deeply in love. And thinking about the way their lives were prematurely snuffed out had a strangely melancholic effect on me that night. Right from the start, the circumstances surrounding the crash were suspicious. Within a day, before tests on Henri Paul's blood had even been completed, the French authorities had leaked a story to the press that this was a simple accident caused by a driver who was drunk as a pig. Although the only alcohol he seems to have consumed that night was 2 Ricards, less than 1/4 of the amount the French authorities claimed he'd drunk.
Show some CCTV of him.
He certainly seemed sober minutes before he drove the Mercedes, and within hours of the crash, French police had allowed a road-sweeping van to wash away all the evidence. What a coincidence. That's exactly what the Pakistan police did in 2007, when they immediately hosed down the place where Benazir Bhutto was assassinated. It's so much easier to claim that a death was just an accident if the evidence has been washed away.
Day 73, 2:40 p.m.
It's like my electrician. I was at home last week when he arrived, told him what I was doing, and he immediately turned round and said, oh, yeah, but MI5 did that, didn't they? And the trouble is, intelligent people believe this shit and get carried away with it. I mean, people do love a conspiracy theory, don't they?
Ah, the gentleman of the press. This is the only way most people get to know what's going on at the inquest, and there's no doubt that almost all of the media had already reached their verdict long before the inquest started. Yet most of the hacks covering it didn't understand the detailed evidence they were hearing, and had no idea of how the establishment was manipulating events behind the scenes and deciding what could and could not be said. The coroner even prevented the jury from knowing about the state of the relationship between Philip and Diana. The prince's letters were redacted, as the court called it, or censored into incomprehensibility, as the rest of us call it. When a close friend of Diana's wanted to tell the inquest about deeply hostile letters that the prince had written to Diana not long before her death, she was forbidden to do so.
Simone Simmons, friend of Diana.
Initially, I had great hopes for the inquest, until I got the gagging order on me. Somebody came in and said, oh, you're not allowed to mention the content of the Prince Philip letters. And in effect, it's like having gagging orders slapped on me. The first one was making aspersions on her moral character. It was doubting her faithfulness to Charles before Harry was born. And you just wonder how many people have been paid off in this whole charade is not fully transparent. If I've had a gagging order, other people have had a gagging order.
Why weren't the press more suspicious? Well, journalists have to answer to their editors, who answer to their proprietors, who all want knighthoods. The upshot being that most journalists are instinctively pro-establishment and are unwilling to accept that the official story about Diana's death just does not make sense. Well, it's difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on him not understanding it.
This is a television interview with Diana from 1995.
The most daunting aspect was the media attention. And I seem to be on the front of a newspaper every single day. And the higher the media puts you, place you, is the bigger the drop.
Just after midnight on the 31st of August 1997, Diana and Dodie left the Paris Ritz in a Mercedes driven by Henri Paul. Diana sat in the rear right seat. She habitually wore a seatbelt. But on this occasion, she did not put it on. When the car was subsequently examined by a crash expert on behalf of the Metropolitan Police, the rear right seatbelt was found to be defective. Had it been tampered with? Was this why Diana was not wearing a seatbelt that night? And why was the inquest not told about this? Some of the paparazzi outside the hotel set off in pursuit, but their scooters and motorcycles were unable to keep up with a much more powerful car. Police evidence given at the inquest confirmed that by the time the Mercedes entered the Alma Tunnel, all the pursuing paparazzi had been left far behind. Yet eyewitnesses saw several motorcycles and a white Fiat Uno surrounding the Mercedes and blocking its progress as it entered the tunnel. There was a very bright flash. Then the white Fiat Uno collided with the Mercedes, which lost control and crashed headfirst into a concrete pillar.
Michael Mansfield, QC, counsel to Mohamed Al-Fayed.
All the other vehicles have never been identified. And they've certainly been excluded as being paparazzi because there was a very close analysis done of all the known paparazzi who were on duty that night. And they could all be accounted for.
So, who was riding those motorcycles? Who was driving the white Fiat Uno?
John Morgan, author of two books on the Diana inquest.
Witnesses saw the Mercedes being closely pursued and surrounded by several motorcycles as it drove into the Alma Tunnel. Now, the jury in their verdict found that following vehicles were guilty of manslaughter. The media read following vehicles and translated into paparazzi. Now, the jury never said that.
So the question is, who owned or who was driving the other vehicles, either motorcycle or car?
The jury decided that these unidentified drivers had committed a criminal act. So why are neither the French nor British police trying to trace these killers?
Day 89, 11:20 a.m.
Do MI6 kill people? Are they allowed to? Sir Richard Dearlap said he was unaware of MI6 ever having assassinated anyone.
Piers Morgan.
When you have the head of the British Security Services calmly announcing we have never killed anybody in the last 50 years, I laughed out loud. What's the point of them then? Now, we've all been to James Bond movies, thanks. We know the security services do a lot of dark stuff. So the idea that we're supposed to believe that in 50 years the British secret agents have never actually killed anyone, I didn't believe it. And so if you don't believe that, where does that leave the rest of the establishment evidence?
Of all the lies told to the inquest, the most absurd was that the British secret services have never killed anybody. This shameless lie was exposed by Richard Tomlinson, a former MI6 agent, who gave evidence to the inquest by video link from France. He couldn't come to Britain because if he had, he would have been instantly arrested. Tomlinson saw a secret MI6 plan to assassinate a Serbian leader in a car crash in a tunnel by flashing a very bright light into the driver's eyes.
Richard Tomlinson, former MI6 officer.
At first, I just thought it was a joke, and I refused to believe the officer when he told me about it, because he, first of all, outlined it to me verbally. And then I went back to see him a couple of days later for another matter, and he sort of gave me a copy of he showed me the minute to sort of prove that he hadn't been joking about it. And so that's, I remember that very clearly.
Baroness Daphne Park, former MI6 senior agent.
Well, there have been other times in my life where I have been involved in death, yes.
but I can't talk about that.
Curiously, several witnesses who were near the Alma Tunnel at the time of the crash reported seeing a bright flash seconds before the collision. Have you ever driven at night when some careless driver is coming at you with his headlights on full beam? Imagine that, 100 times as bright in a narrow tunnel. The result would be exactly what happened to Diana and Dodie's car.
I don't think many people would want me to be queen. Actually, when I say many people, I mean the establishment that I'm married into, because they've decided that I'm a non-starter.
The world's slowest ambulance. Lauren Booth, journalist.
The question that haunts me is around the time of the crash, that she wasn't taken more rapidly to a hospital. There was a sort of time period that wasn't properly explained about her treatment on the ground.
The crash occurred at 12:23 a.m. Dodie and Henri Paul died instantly. The bodyguard, Trevor Rees, was seriously injured. Diana was injured, but was conscious and alert. And had she received prompt hospital treatment, she could well have survived, but she didn't. Instead, an ambulance containing Dr. Jean-Marc Martino arrived at the scene. Although other ambulances were also present, he took sole charge of the princess and made a series of bizarre and disturbing decisions that sealed her fate. It took an astonishing 37 minutes after the crash for Dr. Martino to remove the still conscious Diana from the Mercedes and put her in his ambulance. Odd, because the back of the car was undamaged. It took an extraordinary 81 minutes after the crash before the ambulance even set off for the nearby hospital. Oddly, it made no radio contact with Ambulance HQ throughout the journey. It took an inexplicable 1 hour and 43 minutes after the crash before the ambulance arrived at the nearby hospital, having travelled there at a snail's pace on empty roads. By then, Diana's life was ebbing away. At the inquest, experts agreed that her life could have been saved had it not been for the suspiciously slow and furtive actions of Dr. Martino and his crew, the other members of which have never been officially identified or interviewed.
Day 27, 2:55 p.m.
There is no dispute that at about 12:26, the emergency services in Paris were notified that there had been a serious car crash. There were two dead, two seriously injured. So all it needed at 12:35, if I may say so, through you, was one call saying, look, I think we may have a real problem here. Please be at the ready.
Professor Tom Treasure.
That is precisely the conclusion that we would have put in our report.
Day 9, 2:17 p.m. Nicholas Witchell, the BBC's royal correspondent, is asleep in the press tent.
The BBC's chief royal correspondent used to pay particularly close attention. Here's the guy that considers himself to be effectively the Walter Cronkite of British television. He's in front of arguably the story of the decade. It's unfolding, but he doesn't even have to dig it up. It's happening right in front of him. And the guy falls asleep. And not just once, but several times.
I do things differently because I don't go by a rule book, because I lead from the heart, not the head. And albeit that's got me into trouble in my work, I understand that. But someone's got to go out there and love people and show it.
There was a powerful reason why the secret services of Britain, France and America might have wanted Diana dead. It was Diana's involvement in the campaign to ban landmines. A worldwide movement to ban anti-personnel landmines gathered speed during 1996. To everyone's surprise, even the world's most powerful politician was sympathetic to the ban.
Bill Clinton speaking in Washington on the 16th of May, 1996.
To end this carnage, the United States will seek a worldwide agreement as soon as possible to end the use of all anti-personnel landmines.
Diana, Princess of Wales, took up the cause with a vengeance. In January 1997, she visited Angola, resulting in the greatest photo opportunity that the landmine campaign had ever had.
One down. 17 million to you.
Firing.
Her involvement caused huge anger amongst governments. In Britain, Government Defence Minister Earl Howe denounced her.
Two newspapers this morning quoting unnamed minister described as a loose cannon.
Simone Simmons was with Diana in February 1997, when a government defence minister made a threatening phone call warning the princess to end her involvement with the campaign, otherwise accidents could happen.
The phone went in her little lounge and she picked it up and then called me over And there was a voice that was in the middle of conversation saying, don't meddle in things you know nothing about. Accidents can happen. She went a bit pale. She took it as a threat. And she said that was Nicholas Soames. I don't know his voice, but it was very, very plummy.
Days before she died, Diana made another visit to landmine victims, this time in Bosnia. Again, there was global press coverage, which made her even more of an enemy to many powerful forces in the armaments industry. Diana was certain that her phones were being tapped by the British secret services.
Every time she'd hear a click, she used to say, boys, time to change the tape.
We now know that her calls were also being monitored by the American secret services. After years of denial, they finally admitted to having almost 1,200 pages of transcripts, although they refused to make most of them public, claiming it would threaten national security. Her landmine campaign was clearly infuriating the armaments industry, while her love affair with Dodi Fayed was infuriating the royal family and the British establishment. So there were an awful lot of people who wanted Diana and her Muslim lover dead.
It's weird that at a time when you know the establishment can think of nothing worse than Dodi Fayed, son of Muhammad, marrying and possibly impregnating Diana, that she's conducting a major international offensive against landmines with all the crippling economic problems that would bring for the British establishment again.
And America.
And America. But if you add all these to the mix, then if you were ever going to do something dodgy to Diana, that's the time you would do it. She'd become trouble, as she used to say to me. I'm trouble to them. I won't go away. I won't go quietly.
Presidents have been killed for less.
Noel Botham, author of The Murder of Princess Diana.
I think it was an opportunist killing. They had until September the 19th.
Why until then?
Because that was when the conference was going to take place in Oslo on landmines.
Less than 3 weeks after the crash, the key Oslo meeting began. With Diana out of the way, most of the world's press didn't even bother to attend.
When they killed Diana on the 31st of August, 19 days later, Bill Clinton was the only Western leader who voted against a ban on landmines, something he would never have done...
if she was alive.
...had he had to look in Diana's eyes.
Many investigators believe that this was the real reason Diana was killed. Yet, the coroner barely raised the issue. In the years before Princess Diana was killed, she told many people that the British establishment was planning to eliminate her.
Simone Simmons, friend of Diana.
Oh, of course Diana was bumped off. She knew she was going to be bumped off. But she always said she's not going to make old bones.
Diana asked her lawyer, told him that she had from a very confidential source in the palace, Prince Philip, planning to get rid of her in a car accident.
She wrote this letter to her butler, Paul Burrell, telling him that the royal family were planning her death. Diana said the same thing to her lawyer, Lord Mishkin, who made a note of a prediction. This old British establishment lawyer realised that the note could have devastating consequences for the royal family. So 3 weeks after her death, he handed it to Britain's chief policeman, Lord Condon. The police chief also realised its significance, so he concealed it and kept it secret for 3 years.
Day 53, 10:56 a.m. Michael Mansfield, QC, counsel to Mohammed Al-Fayed.
First question, and you've agreed, is there a legal obligation to hand over potentially relevant material? There's an unequivocal answer to that, which is yes. Agree?
Yes, I do.
That was Britain's top policeman admitting that he broke the law by concealing this devastating evidence.
Right. Well, I'm going to make it very plain to you, Lord Condon, that the reason why potentially relevant material was not handed over to the coroner is because you were sitting on it, knowing that something had gone wrong in Paris, linked to the activities of British state agencies.
You are suggesting, are you, that Lord Condon was part of a criminal conspiracy?
Well, I'm suggesting, yes, that he's part of an agreement.
That is one of the most serious allegations that could ever be made of someone in my position, and I unequivocally, totally refute it as a blatant lie.
Fabrice Dubest, French lawyer.
If, in September 1997, this information had gone public, nobody would have spoken anymore about the paparazzi, about Henry Paul, The only thing the whole world would have focused on would have been Diana's fears, Diana's predictions on how she would be killed by the British establishment.
In 1995, Diana summarized her fears in a phone call to a producer of this film.
If you're a strong woman in my environment, you're a problem. So I'm a hell of a problem. I don't have time, an awful lot of time for hobbies, but keeping alive, one of them. Keeping alive, keeping alive, keeping alive, keeping alive.
Sadly, she signally failed in this quest. Lord Condon wasn't the only senior policeman to hide the lawyer's note. Lord Stevens, his successor as police chief, concealed it for a further 3 years. Both men broke the law. Both men were made lords by the Queen.
I'd like to be a queen of people's hearts, in people's hearts. But I don't see myself being queen of this country.
A very peculiar autopsy.
Diana died soon after arrival at the hospital, and although she had been stripped of her royal status in life, in death her corpse mysteriously became royal property. Within hours, royal representatives had given orders for her body to be partially embalmed, a process that conveniently made it impossible for anyone to tell if she had been pregnant. Attention then turned to the body of the driver, Henri Paul. Before blood tests had even been completed, the French authorities were already insisting that he was drunk as a pig, although the only alcohol he is known to have consumed that night were two single Ricards. This is Henri Paul minutes before the fatal crash. Far from looking drunk as a pig, he seems to be sober as a judge. An autopsy was carried out on Henri Paul's body by Professor Dominique Lecomte, a doctor who is notorious in France for covering up medical evidence that is likely to embarrass the state. If her own account is to be believed, she conducted the world's worst autopsy on the corpse of Henri Paul, committing at least 58 basic errors. Every medical expert at the inquest agreed that her results were not only inept, but biologically inexplicable too, and that her report was untruthful.
Day 56, 10:31 a.m. Richard Keane, QC, counsel to the parents of Henri Paul.
We have Professor Lecomte giving an account of events which, on the face of it, cannot be true.
Professor Robert Forrest, police pathologist.
So you are pushing at an open door. There are clear inconsistencies in Professor Lecomte's account.
The blood tests carried out by Dr. Pepin were equally unbelievable.
We are all agreed that the explanation offered by Dr. Pepin and Professor Lecomte together for carboxyhemoglobin concentrations in the blood samples is implausible and can be discounted.
Yes, so one is left with either analytical error or a mystery.
Suspicions grew at the inquest that the blood tested by Lecomte and Pepin had not come from Henri Paul at all, not least because it contained lethally high levels of carbon monoxide.
Day 62, 10:45 a.m.
The Professor, you said you found it astonishing, the similarity. 1.73, 1.74, 1.75. What are you suggesting there? That suggests to you that the results have been cooked, or what?
Professor Athol Johnston.
That would be my interpretation.
You mentioned that one explanation is that the blood samples didn't, in fact, come from Henri Paul.
That's the most obvious explanation, that it isn't actually Henri Paul's blood we're looking at.
The idea of a classic switcheroo may sound far-fetched, but every scientist involved in the inquest signed a joint statement saying that the blood test results for Henri Paul were biologically inexplicable. Professor Lecomte and Dr. Pepin refused to attend the inquest, even though as citizens of the European Union, they were legally obliged to. They were protected by the French government, who publicly cited reasons of public order for the refusal. However, it has since emerged that the real reason was the protection of state secrets and the essential interests of the nation.
This is the law the Ministry of Justice has used to help and protect Professor Lecomte and Dr. Pepin. So the fact, the legal fact, is that there are state secrets that are protected and that Professor Lecomte and Dr. Pepin know about.
In 2006, a team of scientists offered to carry out DNA analysis on some of the samples to determine if the blood really was Henri Paul's. They were told by the French authorities that the samples no longer exist.
Well, my husband's side were very busy, stopping me. Diana was unstable. They decided that was the problem.
The inquest spent weeks examining Diana's love life in minute detail and considering whether she was pregnant when she died. But why?
Noel Botham, author.
Whether Diana was pregnant or not, or whether she was actually going to marry Dodi Fayed or not, is not important. Mm-hmm. It's whether the establishment believed she was pregnant or believed she was going to marry Dodi. That's important. And there's no doubt at that moment the majority of them did believe both those things.
What did become clear was that within hours of Diana's death, her body was pumped full of embalming fluid, so no pregnancy tests were possible. And soon after, she had her reproductive organs removed under the watchful eye of the royal coroner.
Mohammed Al-Fayed.
There is a trip, the trip from Paris to 45. How can you embalm a body and very short distance of travel?
Why do you think they embalmed her, to hide the pregnancy?
Because they had to corrupt the body because she was pregnant. She had to take all her guts.
So, was Diana pregnant at the time of her death? We'll never know for sure, because the French and British authorities destroyed the evidence. And the blood tests which were taken when she arrived at the hospital, and which could have confirmed if she had just become pregnant, have mysteriously vanished. But ask yourself this. Would the British establishment have allowed Muslim blood to enter the royal lineage? And how far would they be prepared to go to stop it happening?
Lauren Booth, journalist and sister-in-law of Tony Blair.
Deep down, we see them now as an establishment that are capable of murder, which is quite serious.
A private phone conversation between Diana and a friend, recorded by the British Secret Service in 1989 and made public in 1992 in an attempt to damage Diana's reputation.
I was very bad, Lawrence, and he started blubbering. I just felt really sad and full of empty. I thought, bloody hell, what have I done for this family?
If you want to be like me, you've got to suffer.
Richie.
Yep, you have to. And then you get what you...
Get what you want.
No, get what you deserve, perhaps.
Unelected power.
There is no doubt that the entire inquest was skillfully manipulated by powerful unelected forces to the advantage of the royal family. This could only happen because Britain is, in essence, a monarchy, not a democracy. Much of Britain still operates on a system of unelected power. And at its centre are the Windsors, the old aristocracy, and their vast wealth. Just as in medieval times, the royal family live a life of unfettered privilege, with British taxpayers funding their lavish existence.
Professor Stephen Hassler.
Where do we get off on this argument? Only one family, and by the way, a highly unrepresentative family, has the right to a seat to the head of stateship of our country. Now, I think that is a fundamentally flawed argument, and I don't know how it can be used in the modern world.
The idea of a hereditary ruler is as absurd as the idea of a hereditary mathematician.
Officially, the royal family cost British taxpayers £40 million a year, but that's just the tip of a very large iceberg. The royal palaces are maintained by the taxpayer, even private ones, such as Balmoral. Windsor Castle is theirs too, except, of course, when it burnt down, when the bill for rebuilding it also fell on the public purse. Their wealth includes the vast royal art collection, which is worth billions of pounds and belongs to the British people, yet the people aren't allowed to see it. In return, the royal family refused to obey many British laws, such as the 1968 Race Relations Act. As can be seen from this footage, there are very few non-whites in the royal household. Indeed, it is ironic that the ritual ceremony we are now watching is called Trooping the Colour, because as you can observe, there's barely a non-white face to be seen. The royal family are notorious for their racism. This racism is nothing new. There was a close relationship between the British royal family and the Nazis during the 1930s, details of which remain a closely guarded secret.
Were you surprised when you started to find out about, specifically, their relationship with high-ranking Nazis? I mean, Phillips, especially.
Kitty Kelly, investigative biographer.
I was very surprised when I found out about Philip's sisters and their connection to Hitler. The fact that the Queen Mother and her husband were inclined more towards Hitler in the beginning.
So why does Britain still tolerate its racist royal family? The only serious argument that defenders of the monarchy can muster nowadays is that the royals are good for tourism, and even that is suspect.
They're not good for tourism.
That's what they say.
Whenever someone says that, I always think, right, so countries that don't have a royal family then, like Ireland or France or America, no tourists ever go there then. Because tourists would go to the top of the Eiffel Tower, look out and go, oh, I don't know, it's not a bad view, but the lack of a monarch spoils it somehow.
Despite presenting itself as a charming and picturesque relic of the past, the royal family retains a ruthless grip on power in 21st century Britain. It presides over a corrupt and corrosive honours system that keeps tens of thousands of public officials in permanent obedience to the monarchy, all hoping for a knighthood or an OBE in return for a lifetime's loyal service. These are the people who operate Britain's system of government. Judges, coroners, civil servants, police chiefs, permanent private secretaries, members of the secret services and privy councillors.
When I became a cabinet minister, I was made a privy councillor. You swear that you will protect the Queen from all foreign prelates, potentates and powers, and you will report on colleagues if they're disloyal and so on. And they read it to me, and I said at the end, I didn't agree. And they said, you don't have to agree. So I said, what do you mean? They said, we've administered the oath. Now, that phrase, the administration of oaths, which people would have heard, means you're injected with the oath. I've been injected with an oath.
The royals don't only use honours and oaths of allegiance to preserve their power. They use intimidation too, as Diana found to her cost. They demand absolute secrecy and loyalty from their subjects, and they stifle dissent.
Dr. Piers Brendan, historian.
I think of the establishment, our establishment, as a kind of a legal mafia, whose watchword really is the watchword of the real mafia, omerta, silence.
That's why many people regard them as gangsters. Gangsters in tiaras. And given Prince Philip's Nazi background, is it really so unthinkable that those at the top of the present-day British establishment might go to any lengths to rid themselves of a turbulent princess?
Well, anything good I ever did, nobody ever said a thing, never said well done or was it okay. But if I tripped up, which invariably I did, because I was new at the game, a ton of bricks came down on me.
Day 61, 4:18 p.m.
Still, successful producer, Dodie, wasn't he? I mean, what did he ever produce? That's what he produced. He produced his inquest by dying, you know, successfully getting himself killed. He's just a typical rich man's son, you know. Talentless son of a rich father, then pisses all his dad's money out the wall. You think of that stereotype? And that's Dodie.
The media called this the Diana inquest, forgetting that it was also an inquest into the death of Dodie Fayed. In life, Dodie was described by the Duke of Edinburgh as an oily bedhopper. In death, he was dismissed by the press as a worthless playboy. But the inquest revealed these descriptions to be wholly untrue.
He loved to make movies. He liked that ability to make movies. That was his chosen profession.
The other good thing that came out of the inquest, why it was successful, is that it cleared Dodie's name. The evidence was overwhelming about the kind of guy he was. Not a playboy. Actually, straightforward, really caring, sensitive, funny man.
He was smart, Dodie. He understood everything about his father's profession and his profession. He told me on so many occasions, I want to run a studio. I want to have a studio of my own.
Dodie first showed his cinematic talent in 1981 as executive producer of the Oscar-winning film Chariots of Fire.
But Chariots of Fire, think of any British movie, have four Oscars in the same time.
So it's ostensibly a film about a Jew taking on the establishment.
That's right. I mean, the racism, you know, again. And this was unbelievable. Way of thinking that he have the idea.
Following the crash in 1997, there was an outpouring of grief for Diana in the press. But the media virtually ignored Mohammed Al-Fayed's devastation over the loss of his son, Dodie.
I've seen him crying, telling me how he shared a bed with Dodie every day of his life from 2 to 13, after his mother left. When you hear things like that, you know how close they were.
Some questions regarding the mysterious Henri Paul.
Despite lasting 6 months and claiming to be an in-depth investigation, the inquest failed to find answers to many basic questions regarding Henri Paul. If he really was a chronic alcoholic, this would have been diagnosed during the stringent medical examination he underwent 3 days before the crash while renewing his pilot's license. But he passed the medical with flying colours. So why wasn't the doctor who gave him a clean bill of health called to the inquest or ever interviewed by the police? Why did Britain's top policeman, Lord Stevens, tell Henri Paul's parents in 2006, in front of other policemen who kept a written record of the conversation, that their son was definitely not drunk? Yet 6 weeks later, Lord Stevens published a report claiming that Henri Paul was drunk. So, who was lying, Lord Stevens or Lord Stevens? After the crash, the police searched Henri Paul's apartment twice. The first time, all the police found was an unopened bottle of champagne and a quarter bottle of martini, which hardly supports the claim that he was an alcoholic. So the police returned a few days later. And, would you believe it, this time they claimed to have found enough alcohol to stock an entire bar. Beer, wine, Ricard, bourbon, vodka, port, champagne, cassis, peanut. The inquest heard undisputed evidence of Henri Paul's links to the French secret services, the Direction de la Surveillance du Territoire, and to Britain's MI6.
Richard Tomlinson, former MI6 officer.
I just remember reading this file and thinking it was interesting that, first of all, they had a Frenchman working for MI6, because it's actually quite rare to find someone who is French who prepared to work for MI6, because they quite often don't. And secondly, because I'm a pilot myself, I remember this particular person having an interest in flying.
So why did the coroner tell the jury in his summing up that Henri Paul had no links to the security services? Henri Paul's bank accounts show he received a total of 350,000 French francs of unexplained income during the final months of his life, mostly from checks. Why didn't the inquest establish who had written those checks or examine the transactions made on Henri Paul's 5 credit cards or allow the jury to see his mobile phone records? Why did Henri Paul go missing from the hotel for 7 minutes at 10:36? Was he meeting an accomplice in the Place Vendôme? What about the gesture that Henri Paul made outside the Ritz moments before driving off in the Mercedes? Was it a signal to an accomplice? If the inquest had failed to answer one or two of these simple questions, you might put it down to incompetence. But its failure, even to ask many of them, can only have happened because the authorities already knew the answers and wanted to keep them hidden. Henri Paul was not drunk and was working for the Secret Services on the night that he died. Day 68. The only senior representative of the royal household to appear at the inquest was Sir Robert Fellowes, the Queen's private secretary. On day 68, while under oath, he had the following interchange with Michael Mansfield. Were you on holiday at the time? I was on holiday from early, well, somewhere around the first week of August. Until? The week after the death of the Princess and Mr. Al-Fayed. And I went back to Balmoral on the following Sunday, I think, after the funeral. So, would it be fair to say that you were not, in fact, therefore, at the palace or nearby when all of this was happening? I was at the palace, certainly, until the end of July. Fellowes unequivocally told the inquest that he was on holiday for the entire period before and after Diana's death and did not return to work until after her funeral. Now, let's move to January 2011 and the publication of the diary of Tony Blair's press secretary, Alastair Campbell. 31st August. At about 4 a.m, I got a flavour of the royal establishment's approach when I had a conference call with Robert Fellowes. You know about Diana, do you? She's dead. It was all very matter-of-fact. 1st of September, meeting at the Lord Chamberlain's office, attended by Robert Fellowes. 2nd of September, 10 a.m. Fellowes and I had a discussion. 3rd of September, Fellowes called early. 4th of September, I had another discussion with Fellowes. 5th of September, Fellowes said we had all worked well together. Far from being on holiday, as he had claimed under oath, Fellowes was at the very centre of Diana's funeral arrangements, overseeing her burial throughout the week. Fellowes was the man that Diana had described to friends as one of the three names that I fear. He hates me. He will do anything to get me out of the royals. Sir Robert Fellowes was made a lord in 1998.
There's a quote from Prince Philip. In the event that I'm reincarnated, I would like to return as a deadly virus in order to contribute something to solve overpopulation.
This little boy is called Philip. His full name is Philip Schleswig Holstein Sonderberg Glücksberg,
and he grew up in Germany. He was raised amongst his Nazi in-laws, some of whom later became high-ranking members of the SS. His Nazi relatives then sent him to this school in southern Germany, where he studied for a while under the Nazi curriculum. Philip later recalled that there was much heel-clicking and shouts of Heil Hitler were compulsory. And here's Philip, in Darmstadt, in the heart of Germany, in November 1937, attending a family funeral for some of his Nazi in-laws. Marching in front of a Sieg Heiling crowd, this is Philip, next to Christoph, his SS brother-in-law, and Philip, his Nazi stormtrooper brother-in-law. Imagine if a man with a past like this had somehow ended up marrying into British aristocracy. Well, he did.
And as we know,
he got first prize. He became the Duke of Edinburgh, also known as Prince Philip, after marrying Princess Elizabeth, the future Queen of England.
British lawyers have warned us of 87 legal issues concerning this film. Several of those warnings concern the following interview.
And this is with Oliver James, a clinical psychologist.
I think Prince Philip is somebody who is devoid of any internal sense of right and wrong. So deep down, he cares nothing about anybody else. He regards everybody else as potentially a threat. He is completely selfish. And that is very like Fred West or any other psychopathic individual.
Oliver James is one of Britain's leading clinical psychologists. Yet lawyers told us that we could not include his professional diagnosis of Prince Philip in this film. So we looked for the current medical definition of psychopathy and discovered that most psychopaths are not convicted criminals but function normally in society. We also found that psychopaths tend to gravitate towards highly paid professions, such as the legal profession and, oh dear, us, filmmakers. Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip have traditionally been presented to the public as role models for the rest of society. But why?
Noel Botham.
Certainly. I mean, Philip's been in half the beds of England, including two of his wife's close family. But,
Who?
Do you want me to say that? Or
yes, go on.
Princess Margaret and Princess Alexander.
Stop it.
Oliver James.
I don't think that she was somebody who was a kind of would have wanted to marry a psychopath. I think she must have got a very nasty shock when she found out quite how unpleasant he is. But obviously, being the sort of person she is, she said, well, that's it. You know, I've got to stick with this and he's going to shag anything that moves and I can't do anything about that. That's what they all do anyway, isn't it?
Almost everyone has heard rumours about Prince Philip's innumerable extramarital affairs. Yet newspapers have never published full reports, whereas they routinely expose the affairs of pop stars, footballers and other celebrities. Why? Because in Britain, the media dare not challenge the authority of those at the very top.
Oliver James.
I have a friend of mine who was at a party where he was, where he had to observe the disgusting sight of Prince Philip wearing a leather jacket, dancing to a Stone song with his hand halfway up the skirt of some young woman. And that's not an unusual event at all for Prince Philip. He's done that sort of thing many times.
This isn't a question of morality. It's a question of media cowardice.
The British press usually love nothing more than exposing the peccadilloes of eminent people, all except senior members of the royal family who are mysteriously exempt. Funny, that.
You may think that we should have given Prince Philip a right of reply in this film. Well, we did, but he declined our invitation, as did the entire royal family. And they are not the only ones. In fact, if you're wondering why you're not hearing from any members of the British establishment in this film, it's certainly not for want of trying on our part. We asked all of these pillars of the establishment to take part, and they all refused. I wonder why.
The White Fiat Uno.
What you are seeing is what the CCTV camera at the entrance to the Armour Tunnel was recording at the time of the crash. Nothing. Because it was switched off, even though it was usually switched on 24 hours a day. Was that just another coincidence? Or something more sinister? Even though no cameras recorded the crash, it is beyond doubt that a white Fiat Uno collided with Dodie and Diana's car in the tunnel and contributed to their deaths. The French police tried to deny its existence at first, but too many eyewitnesses saw it, and paintwork from a white Fiat Uno was found on the Mercedes where the two cars had collided. So, who was driving it? Suspicions fell on James Anderson, a photographer with connections to the Secret Services. He had been following Dodie and Diana earlier in the month during their holiday in the Mediterranean,
but he was not amongst the paparazzi who were waiting outside the Paris Ritz on the night of the crash.
Noel Botham, author of The Murder of Princess Diana.
Anderson was a millionaire paparazzo, a very well-known member of the paparazzi on the continent, made a great deal of money out of royal pictures, lived in some style in the French countryside.
He told police that he wasn't in Paris on the night of the crash, but gave two completely different accounts of where he had been. His wife and son also gave him contradictory alibis. Privately, he told friends that he had been there in the tunnel in Paris that night. Crucially, Anderson owned a white Fiat Uno.
Brian Basham, writer.
It was said of this Fiat Uno that it was up on chocks and didn't work. Well, that appears to be untrue, too. It was driven many hundreds of miles around the French countryside. So the whole question of the Fiat Uno and who was driving it, which is, of course, absolutely crucial, totally crucial to the investigation, has never been resolved. And you have to say, why?
In May 2000, Anderson's body was found in a blazing car in woodland near Montpellier.
In a Ministry of Defence field, shooting range field, in a car which had burned out and locked, but no keys were in the car or in his pocket. And the police claimed he committed suicide.
They claimed this, even though the fireman who found him says he saw two bullet holes in Anderson's skull. You don't have to be a conspiracy theorist to point out that it's difficult for a man to shoot himself twice in the head and then set fire to his own car before dying.
I would like a monarchy that has more contact with its people.
By the end of the inquest, so much suspicious evidence had been heard that the establishment coroner could take no chances. So he prevented the jury even considering murder as an option. His summing up lasted almost 3 days, during which he continually distorted the evidence, ignored much of the eyewitness evidence, and tried to convince the jury that the crash was nothing more than an accident.
At the start, I told you it was not necessary to solve every subplot in the story.
There are certain matters relating to Henri Paul that simply cannot be resolved with any clarity.
You've not heard in person from Professor Lecomte, Dr. Pepin and others concerned with the analysis of Henri Paul's samples.
In common with most road traffic accidents, this collision did not appear to have a single cause.
The relationship between Diana and Dodi had reached the point where it could no longer be tolerated.
The conspiracy theory has been minutely examined and shown to be without any substance.
Will you please now retire to consider your verdicts?
But the one thing the establishment and the royal courts couldn't fix was the jury. 11 ordinary men and women who ignored the coroner's one-sided summing up and instead spent almost a week examining the evidence for themselves.
Richard Wiseman, diary entry. It's day 93 and we're still waiting for the verdict. Nobody around me can understand why the jury are taking so long. The hacks all expected a verdict of accidental death to be returned within seconds.
Did you see those sandwiches they just took in for the jury? Yeah, I mean, my worry is they look far too good. You know, if they're giving them some curled up meats, you know, they'd agree by two, give the verdict by three, and be home by four.
Fact is, it's becoming painfully obvious that the jury, unlike the press, bothered to listen to the evidence. And they are now analysing it very, very carefully.
A year after the inquest into the deaths of Princess Diana and Dodi Al-Fayed, we asked a cross-section of ordinary people what the jury's verdict was.
Accidental death.
Purely an accident.
It was accident.
Was it accidental?
Accidental death.
It was an accident.
Accidental death, I believe.
It was an actual accident.
Accidental death.
Accidental death.
The answers the public gave us were uniformly inaccurate.
They said the paparazzi, didn't they?
The paparazzi chasing her?
I think, yes, it was for the paparazzi.
Around the world, people have been massively misled by the British media into believing that the deaths were an accident caused by the paparazzi. But in reality, the jury did not blame the paparazzi, and they decided that the crash was not a mere accident, but something much more serious.
Day 94, 4:07 p.m.
In the end, the jury delivered the most powerful verdict that the coroner had left open to them. Unlawful killing is defined in law as homicide or manslaughter. And the jury blamed the following vehicles, not the paparazzi.
Michael Mansfield, QC.
What is also interesting overlooked, I think, almost totally by the media and commentators, was the wording of the verdict. Well, the detail of this verdict was such that it was an unlawful killing contributed to by, and one of the factors was, following vehicles, not the paparazzi.
Initially, journalists were confused, but within minutes, the BBC was reporting that the jury had blamed the paparazzi, and the rest of the media followed the example of the British establishment's impartial broadcaster. Soon, the verdict had been spun by the media into an accident caused by the paparazzi. And so,
a lie
got halfway around the world while the truth was still putting its boots on. The altered verdict was still on the BBC's news website at the time of making this documentary.
Whether it was a case that the commentators, in the end, wanted it to be the paparazzi, and so immediately assumed that, and hadn't, and often some of them didn't really follow it on a daily basis. They might read in the odd transcript. And certainly a change of that kind, which was very important because following vehicles was a much bigger category than just paparazzi because of the reasons I've just given, that nobody either wanted to understand what that meant or, if they did, weren't prepared to include it in their commentaries.
The media declared that Mohammed Al-Fayed had been defeated. But in reality, the jury's verdict supported what he'd been saying all along. Diana and Dodi were unlawfully killed. 2011. And the British media, after seriously misreporting the verdict, refuse even to discuss what the verdict really means. Their deafening silence speaks volumes about the deeply troubling outcome.
Oliver James.
There was a feeling of openness about it. And yet, at the end of it, I have to say, even as a supposedly educated scientific person, I would still say I don't feel that at all confident that it got to the bottom of it.
Laurie Taylor.
People will still go on thinking there is something happening here because they know the British establishment, they know their capacity for cover-ups. The newspapers in this country really don't want to upset the very top.
Lauren Booth.
The most bizarre thing is that normal people in this country who don't necessarily enjoy conspiracy theories, if you go to a bar, you'll find three people who go, ooh, but the royals did it, didn't they?
Piers Morgan.
I think most of the British public still believe it was dodgy. I believe Mohammed Al-Fayed will always believe it's dodgy. I believe the establishment want it all to just go away for whatever reason, and I don't know the answers to these questions. All I know is that the inquest has probably raised more questions than in the end it answered, and it answered a lot of questions.
Oliver James.
I would still say it was fantastically convenient for the monarchy that this woman died. Just think what she might be saying now if she hadn't died. Think what a problem it would have created for Camilla. Think of, it would have created serious constitutional problems that even she was perfectly capable of being somebody who started a movement to end the monarchy.
The full facts about the Alma Tunnel crash may never be known, but we do know this for certain. Dodi and Diana were the victims of an unlawful killing, and various parts of the establishment, with their unerring instinct for mutual self-preservation, then seemed to have rallied around to cover it up. They covered for each other and suppressed uncomfortable facts, and they think that they have got away with it. The British establishment think that they have got away with murder. But then what's new? They've been getting away with murder for centuries. Since the crash, some curious things have happened. Charles has married Camilla, as he'd always wanted to. MI6 now publicly admit that they have been involved in killings. Diana has been airbrushed out of official royal history. No action has been taken against the police chiefs who suppressed Diana's sworn statement predicting that the royal family would kill her in a car crash. Instead, they both now sit in the House of Lords. Mohammed Al-Fayed was ordered by Prince Philip to take down the royal warrants that had hung for decades outside Harrods. And shortly before selling the store in 2010, and more in sorrow than in anger, he symbolically burned them in sight of his son's grave.
I am destroying this royal crest as a tribute to my son, Dodi. I feel that he is looking down
on this today. There was a clear verdict of unlawful killing. So why has nobody been arrested? What is at the core of all this is racism. Powerful people in this country, my country, don't want to hear me talking about Prince Philip's Nazi background, but I have to, because it's just 100% true. They wouldn't accept me or my son. And when he fell in love with Diana, they murdered them.
Despite obtaining a verdict that vindicates his years of struggle, Mohammed Al-Fayed fights on. Still grieving for his son, he has opted for truth rather than happiness. Legal action is continuing in France against the police chiefs who suppressed vital evidence, and the establishment cover-up is being steadily exposed day by day. Truth will out. And as more and more people come to understand what the damning inquest verdict really means, we may soon witness what the British establishment fears most. The end of the monarchy.
Now we move across the Atlantic for more suppressed information. This is Dean Puckett interviewing Nafees Mossadegh Ahmed about an interview he had with whistleblower Sybil Edmonds. This is the third Crisis of Civilization podcast, and it was published in May 2013.
I'm Dean Puckett. I'm the director of the documentary The Crisis of Civilization. And you can find me and my other film work at deaddeanfilms.co.uk. I'm here today with Nafees Mossadegh Ahmed, the author of The User's Guide to the Crisis of Civilization and How to Save It. Our podcast today is going to focus on a new article that Nafees is writing about the FBI whistleblower Sybil Edmonds. Nafees, maybe you could just tell the listeners who Sybil Edmonds is and a little bit about her.
Sybil Edmonds is a former FBI translator who was contracted by the FBI to translate intelligence that they had been developing in the years prior to and up to 9/11. And she specializes in kind of in Persian, Turkish, Azerbaijani languages. And she got her job shortly, a couple of weeks after the 9/11 attacks, when the FBI was kind of obviously scrambling to develop a kind of big picture understanding of what the hell had happened, and had realised that their language capabilities were pretty dismal, and they needed to bring new people in. So Sybil Edmonds began working for the FBI. I think it was late September she actually got the contract in 2001. And she worked with them for about 6 months or so, and then she ended up being fired. And what subsequently emerged from all of this experience that she had at the FBI was a spate of quite shocking revelations about high-level corruption in the US national security system, starting at the lowest levels of the FBI in the Washington field office where she was working, going all the way up to the Pentagon, the US State Department, the CIA, the Justice Department, the US Cabinet, as well as congressmen from both parties. And it was a really, really entrenched web of corruption that she'd uncovered.
And in researching this article, you've had a long recorded Skype chat with her, which we'll cut to intermittently through the podcast.
So I'm recording now.
Okay.
You are the most gagged woman in American history. And I mean, arguably, probably the most gagged person, you know, in modern times. It's really amazing. What is it about what you discovered in this? Was it about 7 months, 9 months or something? You're working right for the FBI. What was it that you discovered that was so explosive that you brought the entire machinery of the US government on your head?
Let me start with my languages. My primary language is Turkish. The secondary language, it would be almost equal, is Farsi, the language spoken in Iran. And because of that, I'm also able to, not as a verbatim pro, but I understand a lot of Dari language. Dari language is about 80%. It's like a Persian Farsi dialect. Azerbaijani is because of my father's background, and of course English, because both I studied in English in Turkey, but then I came and I went to universities here. My degrees is very simple. I have two bachelor's degrees. I have one in criminal psychology, the other one in criminal justice from George Washington University. Yeah, you're right. They consider this classified. But then yeah. I got a master's degree in public policy, U.S. public policy from George Mason University. And my work background up until the work that I did with the FBI, I never worked for the government. I did some volunteer work for the criminal justice system in Virginia, for juvenile court in Alexandria. I dealt with sexually abused children. And other than that, it's been private business. I traveled extensively until 2000. I had one job temporarily in Russia right after the fall of the Soviet Union, 1992-1993, with Rostropovich Foundation, which dealt with children hospitals in back then Leningrad, St. Petersburg. Now, with the FBI, I want to emphasize, like, I did not discover anything by myself.
Yeah.
These investigations, operations were ongoing since 1996 and not through one field office. And that was where I work, FBI Washington, D.C. field office, but also FBI field offices elsewhere, especially specifically in Chicago. And these discoveries and all the suspicions of some of the activities that later through investigation produced explosive results were being carried out long before I joined the FBI. But what happened was, since it was right after 9/11, and since these different field offices and different operations being separated both through bureaucracy but also intentionally, for example, FBI, Turkish counterintelligence could not talk with or share information with FBI Turkish Criminal Division, and the FBI Criminal Division could not share information and work together with FBI Turkish Counterterrorism Division, because of these separations, that a lot of it was intentional, some of it was due to bureaucracy. So what happened was, I came in there, and I will get into it really more in detail, because it really needs to be explained how and what operations we are talking about. I ended up working, because I was the only language specialist, and up until after 9/11, 3 days after 9/11, FBI was not allowed to have an official Turkish division, whether it's counterintelligence, counterterrorism. They could carry out some monitoring under FISA and pursue some criminal investigations, but they could never have a division that is officially called Turkish division. Wow. They could never have a division that is called UK division, even though we had all the other European countries' division. We had a French division, which, you know, we monitored, when I say we, FBI analysts and translators, their embassy and attaché information, etc. Germany, we did. All, you know, South American countries, we did. Turkey, UK, and Belgium. Three countries, and to a certain extent, Azerbaijan.
Wow, so FBI was, so these four countries were
forbidden.
These four countries had, the FBI was not allowed, essentially, to wiretap them. But they were...
Well, they did, but they were not given any power to pursue the results of any investigations. First of all, the divisions were not official. While the other, for example, FBI has a huge Israel division, okay? It's one of the biggest ones. You know, there's Iran and the Saudi Arabia and all the Arab-speaking nations. But then Israel has a huge division, okay? Yeah. Even though it's an official division, it has a name, the FBI's Israel Counterintelligence Division, Israel Criminal Division. So they have it. They have the power to wiretap as well. But because of political reasons, FBI is always, almost 99.999%, they are forbidden, they are prevented from implementing further actions, whether it's going to courts on espionage cases or if it's criminal cases, that's due to political pressure.
Right.
Now, Turkey and UK and Belgium, the UK embassies cannot be tapped. Okay, that is just. But while you can tap completely the military attaché for, let's say, Turkey and the Turkish embassy and Turkish NGOs or Turkish lobby firms, since it is not recognized as official, and if you find incredible terrorism or espionage cases, you are in a really bad situation in terms of pursuing and doing something about it. Okay? Say, now, even though it's official for Israel division in the FBI, with them, with Israel, is the political pressure. Because, you know, once in a while we hear about, oh, certain wiretaps that came out and implicated a certain congresswoman on AIPAC. Well, AIPAC has known for a long time that they are being wiretapped. And they're so bold. They're like, they don't care because they know that people can't take action. They are prevented by the political powers. Because who is FBI answerable to? It's the executive branch and ultimately is answerable to the White House.
Yeah.
Okay? DOJ White House. And so while you have agents who are, let's say, within this Turkish division, they're working because they find explosive operations, you know, whether it's narcotics related or it's espionage related against Turkey. And they have actually channels to pursue it and bring these people in to justice, whether it's the U.S. counterparts or the Turkish criminals here in the United States through criminal prosecution channels. But then their hands are tied because you have the White House, which takes order from the CIA and the State Department, telling the top layer, maybe the top four or five guys. So all the agents I work with in the FBI, they were really good and they were doing their work, okay? They were good. They were really pursuing these true, real terrorism or criminal or espionage cases. Mm. The top layer answerable to the White House and influenceable completely by the State Department, the CIA, were the ones who were coming and saying, we are shutting down this investigation. Or I give one example that may illustrate it. Besides gathering and collecting information, the agents, also FBI agents, conducted field operations. In one case, we had a Turkish target or targets several individuals under a certain operation. This one was done through Washington, D.C. field office agents. And these targets, we had information about how they were going to bring certain kilogram of heroin through what channel, and it was going to be somewhere in D.C., okay? Hmm. And the field operation, the FBI, and also DEA, this is Drug Enforcement Agency, also was included because this was a joint operation, right? So that morning at 9:15, this particular thing was going to take place, and the DEA agents and the FBI agents, they were having this field operation, and they were going to bust these guys, okay? So they are actually in a van, several SUVs. This is the FBI agents, the DEA agents. And about 15, 20 minutes before the bust, the FBI headquarters, and this is the top, you know, SES level, senior executive level, they contact the field agents in the van, and they say, you call it off. You turn around, and you get the DA agents off. This is called off. Now, agents are pissed. They are like, what? How could this be? I mean, we have all the stuff, and we cannot give you any explanation. This is the two of the targets have diplomatic immunities. Well, we knew that they were not diplomats, okay? And but FBI says, no, well, somebody in the top-level FBI had shared that information with people in the State Department. So between the State Department and the White House, the director's office was being told to call off the operation. Turn around. You're not making this bust. This operation is terminated at this point, ASAP. You're returning back to the field office.
What? So when was this incident?
Well, this is one of many incidents. This particular incident took place in, it would be around end of October 2001. But again, the agents I work for, I work with, I mean, and with the files operations, not only on these particular guys, but other connected target guys, they have had similar things happening to them over and over and over since the beginning of this particular operation in 1996.
These targets were related to this particular operation. What was the investigation? What were these investigations about?
Well, this investigation, FBI's part was they were after these guys because they also had some operation centers in New Jersey, and they brought in, heroin. And this, the source of heroin, I'm not going to go all the way to the original source, but from Turkey to Belgium, from Belgium into the United States.
Yeah.
And, well, let's say if you had four targets, foreign targets, okay, and let's say one of them had a green card but still had dual citizenship, and out of these four targets, two of them were directly connected to Pentagon and the military attaché of Turkey, but they didn't have diplomatic titles.
I see.
So you have a case where there are people who are working with Pentagon, NATO, and the Turkish military attaché who are bringing heroin into the United States. DEA knows about it, the good agents. The FBI knows about it. They want to go and make a bust because this guy doesn't have an official diplomatic cover. But yet the State Department, aka CIA, and the White House, they tell that you terminate this operation. Because what's going to happen? You arrest these guys. This thing comes out, their identities, who they are, the operations. Now you're implicating high-level Turkish military, NATO, and the United States operations military operators. Can you imagine what would happen?
What you're saying is that one of the reasons it seems that this was blocked was because people inside the US government at a senior level actually condoned in some way this criminal activity, this heroin trafficking and all the rest of it. They were actually in some way involved, and they didn't want that involvement to come to light through this operation. Is that
not only that they were involved, they actually participated.
Yeah.
We had well-documented investigation cases that showed a lot of heroin entered the United States through a military plane that landed in Andrews Air Force Base. Okay, one of my whistleblowers, John Cole, he was one of the managers for the counterintelligence, okay, in FBI headquarters. Well, he tried to blow the whistle.
Wow.
Okay, so you have, it's not that, okay, they know, but because they are allies and they are having other use for us, the other way. No, that was not the case. It was, see, this is the whole thing. After I came back from Vietnam, there's a guy who was one of the top attorneys with the Justice Department, not the FBI. And he retired in 2005, 2006. He's not a whistleblower or anything, and he's like one of the system guy. And he said, you know what, Sabelle? That's one of the mistakes, I believe, the DOJ and the State Department, because the decision for the state secrets privilege didn't originate from the FBI. The DOJ implemented it, but the decision came from the State Department, CIA, that they needed to enforce state secrets privilege. My case had to be stopped from any, proceeding in courts. But he said that was their biggest mistake because they panicked, okay? Hmm. But with what you know and what you could have taken out, even though you were not supposed to document-wise from the FBI, that if they let you just talk and take this stuff out there, nobody would have believed anyway.
Yeah.
So they actually made a big tactical mistake because they even gave more attention in some ways and legitimacy by saying, we cannot let her open her mouth.
Yeah.
You let her open her mouth. Well, if I had really gone to court and testified under oath, then I would have said something like, okay, here is the particular office in Pentagon, and here is a particular office in the State Department, and this is the division within NATO that and which is part of it, is the Turkish division of NATO, because Turkey is a NATO ally, and they're engaged in this, including Herod, nobody would have believed me. It would have sounded insane.
The situations that you're describing here, when you go into detail in your book and you explain all of the various strands of investigations that you ended up translating intelligence in relation to, they really are just small facets of this web of criminal activity. On the one hand, some of it was just there was bureaucracy, and there was what you might expect in any organization. There's a lot of bureaucracy and blah blah blah, red tape. Then there were other layers. So the next layer that I thought was interesting was this kind of criminal negligence.
For example, let me start with three points, so that way everything will start maybe making more sense. You just mentioned translation, and I want to also clarify something else here. So let's say you are wiretapping or monitoring a military attaché, Turkish military attaché, and let's say embassy, right? Well, sure, there will be communications that are in Turkish between Turkish actors, targets, right? Some of them are non-targets who are just calling, and you by default hear it. And you know, you're the translator, you translate it. But I would say close to 40, 50% of those communications didn't have to be translated because they were carried out in English, okay? So when Wiretap brings this information to the FBI, it doesn't distinguish which ones are in English, which ones are in Turkish. Now, the targets may be Turkish or Pakistanis, but a lot of conversations are in English. One example of this would be there was a very heated period between summer 2001, and these are both archive and later live monitoring, where on daily basis we sat and listened to Paul Wolfowitz talking to the top military attaché guy, you know, Turkish military attaché, okay, on Iraq. This was before we invaded Iraq. And there were a lot of discussions. There was a lot of they were trying to get, and this is Paul Wolfowitz, the Turkish military, saying, this was actually plans on going and invading Iraq, and Turkey, in order to have U.S. use the base, etc., they had one important condition Turkey was putting there and demanding was like, you let us handle northern Iraq, you know, the whole Kirkuk region, because we have our own interests there with the Kurds and everything. Well, the plan was only United States and United Kingdom. And they said, well, you don't do that, we're not going to let you use our damn base. Hmm. And the middle guys, they're not the top guys, Wolfowitz, were trying to get this thing mild and saying, come on now, look, initially we will do it, but within the first few years, then we would let you to participate in some of the stuff, you know, with Iraq. But initially, we do not want to have that kind of a mess in the northern border. Well, so what I'm trying to say is all this conversation was in English. They didn't need a translator, but it came through the same cable, through the same wiretap. So to hear almost on daily basis Richard Pearl or Paul Wolfowitz talking to the highest level guy in Turkish embassy was a regular occurrence. And agents were able to directly listen to it too. And when you listen, I mean, so much you were finding out that was just mind-boggling. Now, the most troubling, the most important aspect of this case, the state secrets privilege, ended up tying directly to 9/11.
Yeah.
Because the previous, some of them, they were shut down. That's why I'm referring to as previous investigations. They were shut down by the end of 2001, early 2002. Investigations produced all these evidence, documented evidence in the FBI that made it very clear that we, the United States, up until 2001, including at the time of 9/11, we had very close joint operations with Ayman Zawahiri, with Bin Laden, not only one Bin Laden, several Bin Laden family members, including Osama Bin Laden, okay? We had meetings with them. Yeah. In Baku, in Azerbaijan, the U.S. Embassy in Azerbaijan in Baku.
When did those meetings take place?
So there were at least three or four meetings, two of them with Zawahiri, and we had actually from U.S. people going and attending that meeting in the U.S. embassy, including people such as Prince Bandar was in there. We had several known Turkish figures, 1997, 1998, the last one being in late 1999 in Azerbaijan, in Baku, in U.S. embassy.
And the Turkish figures, were they, those were military intelligence or government? Who were these people?
This was, well, one of them was the highest level Turkish general, that is the NATO, Turkish NATO general.
I see.
But also it included a very high level religious figure, which maybe we'll get into it later. This made the entire thing with 9/11 and what the government was saying completely moot.
So it's a massive, it's really a massive and complex web of things that she brings to the fore, which is why I think it's important that people actually read her book and understand how complex these things are, but also how ridiculously facile the picture is that is presented to us in the media about terrorism.
I've taken a lot of heat for saying it goes back to the Crusades.
Barely 100 years after Muhammad's death, the Islamic Empire had spread far and wide. The Pope reacted to the Muslim expansion by launching Christendom's version of holy wars, the Crusades.
And you can just see it happening again.
This kind of, quote, clash of civilizations.
And this could be a defining moment.
That the world needs to march forward.
To deal with the scourge of
the bearded ones.
And see what they have done against mankind.
Because it's only going to happen with all of us together.
The message to Muslim nations and moderate Arabs, Pakistan also, is...
We hold our beliefs every bit as strongly as they hold theirs. And now is the time to show it.
A huge lack of self-reflection about what went wrong with these systems and a projection outwards onto these bad guys. And it's all their fault and they're evil and they hate our freedoms.
Yeah.
Whereas what Sybil's getting into is actually how those bureaucracies work and function, the problems with them, the corruptions within them. But people don't, the mainstream doesn't really want to look at that. They prefer the simple narrative.
Yeah, absolutely. And I, one of the things that came out when I was working on the story was the stuff that she brings out is so big. It's actually probably the biggest scandal that's ever happened in the United States, and yet it's happened under the radar with nobody really knowing about it. I mean, what, you know, we look at what's happening with Bradley Manning, which is absolutely atrocious. We look at what's happening with Julian Assange, and, you know, whatever we think of Julian Assange, you know, this is, it's not about the person, but let's look at the way in which we've seen WikiLeaks and whistleblowing being treated by the Obama administration. It's quite extraordinary. But all of the focus is on those things. But Sybil Edmonds, who is a whistleblower and presides over one of the most credible whistleblowing organizations in America, the National Security Whistleblowers Coalition, and she has something like 70-odd former federal government officials who've worked in national security over the, you know, many of them are veterans who've worked across government, you know, for 10 years, 20 years. All of them basically with insane stories of what has gone on inside the US government and how they've been retaliated against. I mean, so the stuff that she's bringing out really is actually extraordinary, and to the extent that one of her FBI supervisors has actually described the scandal as bigger than Watergate.
How could it be? I mean, we went there in 1997, or was it 1998 during Clinton, and we bombed this pharmaceutical company. So it had to do with Bin Laden. Well, during that period, after that period, we actually officially were meeting with Bin Laden and Bin Laden's group, which was never referred to as Al-Qaeda. It was always still Mujahideen. And to have this documented evidence that was gathered through counterintelligence operations that targeted Turkey. Now, the same thing, they had counterintelligence operation, not my division, but there was a large, and this was an official Pakistan division. And to say, And yes, this guy was wanted for these particular bombings, but yet you have all this evidence, hard evidence. And again, it was not that some CIA faction, they let Mujahideen do that. In fact, indirectly helped. None of that. We officially, in official capacity, we were meeting with these individuals, with this group, all the way till 2001.
You mentioned this Caucasus operation and the Central Asian operations. What, in your view, was the objective of these meetings? Were these part of a wider operation linked to these Mujahideen networks in these countries? Was this? I mean, you mentioned the Cold War, and how that, you know, the Cold War mindset has become even more entrenched in different ways. Was this part of that?
It was, but first, like in the early part of second half of 1990s, in 1997-1998, some of these operations involved actually bringing a lot of people, and included Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, Afghanistan into Turkey. They were trained and actually, their passports were changed. They were given Turkish passports with NATO airplanes. They were taken to the operations that were being carried out. This was during all this Bosnia and Kosovo. And this was, again, official operations. It was not that, oh, these Mujahideens, they had their backpacks and they found their ways through the borders and they ended up in places like Albania. It's not. They came, and they came from Turkish official NATO Turkish planes into certain Eastern blocs in Europe, and that's how they were brought in there.
Yeah.
So in 1997, 1998, there was a lot of those were concentrated on bringing these people into that bloc, the Balkans, and there was some focus there with all the together operations carried out through our Chechen channel there.
Yeah.
But then towards 1999, Azerbaijan became actually a hub that both included the stuff with heroin, but also it was organizing other smaller religious factions in other stands, in other countries like Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan. And this was when Fethullah Gulen, which is his organization worth 20-some billion dollars, he's in the United States, his headquarters is in the United States, he's a Turkish, you know, religious figure. They opened more than 350 what they call madrasas. It's a different version of, it's not exactly the same madrasas the Wahhabis set up in Pakistan, but madrasas and mosques in all this country. Now, granted, in some of these countries that they were more siding with Russians, they kicked them out. They banned Gulens and all these madrasas. But many others, they didn't. So when that was happening, part of these madrasas, the religious schools as part of mosques, that's Gulen's movement together with the U.S., NATO, Turkey factions were setting up in these countries. They had this very strong English language department. If you look at it, I mean, this is not top secret.
Yeah.
If you look at it, they emphasize English language. So you would see hundreds of English teachers, Americans, with diplomatic passports going to these countries to work for Gulen's madrasas, teaching English in religious schools.
Yeah.
And would you give diplomatic passports, Americans going there teaching English in madrasas? It's mind-boggling. But again, these were all done through official, implemented, formal channels. These were not, U.S. saw that some Mujahideens or some people, big people from Saudi Arabia were pouring money into this, and Turkish Gulen was doing that, and they said, you know what, this is to our advantage. Hey, this is a great thing. Be like that. That's not the case. The whole implementation planning, from the planning stage to the implementation, were all taking place here via State Department in Washington, D.C. It was fully being communicated with the Turkish arm of NATO people, whether in military attaché or other military-related organizations in the United States with offices in NATO. So this was not, again, oh, well, you know, our enemies is our friend. That was not the case. And
yeah.
I know it's being reflected. So if my case would have been allowed to proceed in courts, because I know the agents I worked with and I work for, they in fact, during closed meetings, some of these agents, they came and they told all this to these senators. They vouched for these reports, and they would have testified on their oath. Or if the Congress would have deposed them, because initially Congress was going to have public hearings on my case, all these agents from the FBI, they would have told the truth because they were the good guys in this, the FBI agents. But it didn't happen. The hearings were shut down because Congress was gagged in my case, because the CIA, the State Department, they didn't want that. The courts were shut down, and the media, initially during the first couple of years, some of these people, insiders, the agents from the FBI and even from some other agencies, including DEA, they were even willing to sit anonymously. I mean, they would be known to the reporters like New York Times, Washington Post, talk to them, but as long as their names were kept off the record, anonymously, they were cited. Not a single one of those meetings and what they gave these reporters were printed.
Yeah.
And after that, they knew you can't get this information out even if you wanted to.
Why is there this block on these issues which are so significant and critical to U.S. national security and what happened in 9/11? Why was there this strange and bizarre reluctance? And not just reluctance, but this active opposition to investigating these things, and in fact, protection. What does that say about this American national security system?
Well, the seat I call is the hardest question of all. It gets so frustrating to, you know, I see, because I truly appreciate some of the 9/11 truth movement, but then it gets so frustrating to see all these different factions, and I have no idea how many of them are actually set up to be, you know, discrediting factor in there. I mean, you get people who, it's just only about a year ago I realized what in the world was this LIHOP, MIHOP, and people coming and saying, oh, you subscribe to whatever hop, and then this is the other hop, and that's the thing, because what I try to tell people, okay, is that you take all the stuff with the gag orders and what I know, you put together, you have written on this topic, okay? And your book also relies on heavily documented, sourced, right, information. You put together with what happened with, let's say, Colleen Rowley, okay? It's not a huge incident, you know, but you take that, put it together with Robert Wright, Agent Wright in Chicago. You get this thing that we still, it's so convoluted with the Able Danger. You bring all the stuff together and you look and say, it has nothing to do what we are being told about who did 9/11 and why and how we didn't know, or the fact that we didn't know.
Hmm.
Now, it's this thing that they're talking about, LIHOP and MIHOP and all these, I would say, confusing versions and the theories and hypotheses that they're putting forth, I think that actually ends up taking away from the macro picture. Because to say this thing of what make it happen, then you have to look at a lot of people that had to be in it with it, okay? If you ask my personal opinion, this is not an expert opinion, I would say, no, the people like on the from the top layer, second or third year, they did not make anything happen.
Yeah.
Okay? Now, the top people, maybe the top layer, there are indications and so much evidence that they may have let it happen, even afterwards, okay? We see with Yasin al-Qadi, they had, and this is not under only Turkish division, because one of the things that people don't know about Yasin al-Qadi, supposedly he escaped and he got out of the United States. The first place he went for a while was Albania. Mm. But immediately after that, he went to Turkey.
Yeah.
Okay? And a lot of his banking and operations are all placed in Turkey. Again, you're coming to this Turkey, NATO ally Turkey. Is it some ally that is backstabbing us? Absolutely not. It's the other way around. It's the other way around. Turkey is serving the orders and the wishes, and they carry out with the manual and the recipes of what they are given by their bosses, the NATO, US, UK bosses.
Yeah.
So you look at Qadi, ends up in Turkey. All these different bin Ladens and all these people from Saudi Arabia that were taken out, Did FBI agents in the counterterrorism divisions, at least the ones in Washington field office, were they fuming? Did they want to question these people? Absolutely. Who are these? Somebody says, no, you can't question these people. And why? I mean, you can't go and say, here are these people. Then you say, no, you can't investigate these people. Then you look at all the other mysterious things. We are not capturing anyone that we can prove has any relation to 9/11. And the ones we say, they are either dead or we make sure they are killed before they are out in the court. I mean, you put all this stuff together and then say, okay, now look at this and start looking at it from this macro perspective. That is productive. That is getting us close to all these unanswered and questions about 9/11 that should lead us to a path that says stand up, rise, and demand the further truth, but also justice based on that truth. I don't think it's going to happen. We are sitting here 40 years later, and we still don't have answers on Kennedy's assassination, for God's sake, okay? And it's every day, and it's pessimistic, I know, but it looks more and more like this is going to be another one of those chapters in U.S. histories. When they come and they give you this official stories, and it even later throughout the years when bits and pieces of information comes out, it's either too late because people have given up, nobody listens, the media blacks it out, and it just goes nowhere. And you end up with this cult of people who say, here are all these facts. And but that's what happens. We end up being this cult.
Absolutely. I mean, what I think is really powerful, though, about what you have done and the information that you're presenting is that, I mean, one, you don't get involved in all of that kind of theoretical speculation. But most importantly, what I think is interesting is that the stuff that you're talking about gives us a glimpse into a very different, almost parallel universe.
How many thanks to Dean Puckett, Sibel Edmonds and Nafees Mossadegh Ahmed for that production, with which we conclude this look at the parallel universes that lie underneath well-managed fronts presented by the commercially controlled media. This show and all previous episodes are available for download from the Unwelcome Guests archive, unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. If you have ideas for the show or you hear material that you think is worthy of it, do get in touch. You can contact me, unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net.
Listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
This archival recording is part of a tribute to Michael Parenti, the internationally known political scientist, historian, and activist.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Michael Parenti, Capitalism's Apocalypse. Why the rich can't save anyone, not even themselves. Parenti gave this talk on August 23, 2008, in Oakland, California. He predicted the financial crisis that began only weeks later when he said that giant corporate capitalism, by its very nature, is an apocalyptic system. When left to its own devices and unregulated, the built-in elements of ever-increased growth may well bring the whole system down, Parenti said. And he described the growing national debt not as a tragic mistake, but as a means to shift ever more money from the taxpayers to the financial institutions. The speech that you are about to hear is an analysis of the many structural flaws of a capitalist system that puts it on a permanent collision course with democracy. Here is Michael Parenti.
First off, I think we should notice that there's a close relationship between capitalism and democracy. It's an antagonistic relationship. Historically, capitalists have had a hard time dealing with democracy. They opposed, in this country, every democratic advance, the elimination of property qualifications for voting and for office holding. They opposed it with tooth and fang and claw and nail. They opposed the freedoms of an independent press and the strong dissident voices that emerged. They opposed mass demonstrations of dissent. They opposed the right to collective bargaining, the right to public education for all, which would be a basic condition for democracy, for citizenry. They opposed that. They fought against it for generations. They opposed a living wage and safe work conditions, which is a democratic condition. They opposed direct elections of office holders in many cases, even to today. Today, they oppose the direct election of the president. They're sticking with the Electoral College, which, of course, favors these small states, giving them a very loaded additional vote. And those small states usually go Republican, the red states. They opposed more equitable and more democratic modes of representation. They opposed proportional representation. They've gotten a good deal of proportional representation undone in Italy, getting rid of then the whole multi-party social democracy. And so you've got these two left-of-center, right-of-center parties, and it begins to resemble the American alignment in terms of how politics go. They oppose easy access to the ballot. Today, as you see, conservatives, staunch warriors of capitalism, are passing laws in states like Missouri which require proof of birth. There was that case of the one woman who was 85, 86, who had been voting for half a century or more, and who now suddenly had to write to Mississippi to get her birth certificate, and there was no record of it. So she's being disfranchised by these laws. It is their goal to disfranchise, to limit, to constrict, to undermine, to dilute democracy, while keeping certain democratic forms, because those forms legitimate the system and they convince people that they're free and they're self-selecting in their rulers. So we should keep in mind that capitalists, historically speaking, have had a near impossible time trying to act democratic. They often cannot even abide by their own constitution. I mean, it's their constitution. It's not all that democratic. It's full of all sorts of little rigs and snares and whatever else. So to defend their unfair privileges and exploitations, they must act unfairly, undemocratically, and unconstitutionally, using force and violence, deception and manipulation. You know, Eugene Victor Debs, the great American labor leader we know, socialist, he became aware of some of this when he was thrown in jail for struggling for the rights of working people. I mean, there he was, you know, if you've ever been roughed up and thrown in jail, you have time in jail, you could feel the bruise or the cop hit me here. Oh, he hit me here. Oh, and so you're sitting there and you're feeling your aches and knocks. I speak from experience on two occasions. And it really gets you thinking about the democracy that you live in. You know, you say, Jesus, what a democracy. God, thank God for American democracy. Debs, thrown in jail for struggling for the rights of working people, he came to the conclusion that the state was not a neutral arbiter. That's funny. Well, here's a here's a dispute between two private interests, capital and labor, the owners of this factory and the people who work in the factory. There's two private interests. Why does the state come down so heavily on the side of one particular private interest? Why does it come down on the side of capital at such a cost to labor and with such brutality? So Debs came to the realization, as just a regular trade union leader who was trying to organize unions to get people a little more pay, better pay and all that, Debs come to the conclusion that capitalism was not just an economic system, but it was a whole social order that rigged the rules in its favor. And with that realization, of course, he was transforming himself from a labor leader to a socialist leader. While still being a labor leader, they're not mutually exclusive, of course. Now, while uneasy with democracy, while fearful of democracy, the capitalist class and their spokespersons and such make a big play about claiming democracy as their invention. They claim to be its progenitors, even as they subvert it, not only at home, but abroad. In the last half century, the leading capitalist states have undermined, attacked, and destroyed political reform movements and revolutionary movements in countries throughout South America, Central America, Africa, the Middle East. And I'm talking about the Middle East, where we never think, oh, there's no democracy, and this phony president waged the war on Iraq to teach them democracy. Well, the Iraqis had a democratic revolution back in 1958, you know. It was a wonderful thing, broad-based coalition with all sorts of groups, and it was slowly undermined and destroyed through violence and assassination and everything else. The leader of the counter-revolutionary movement was a guy who was trained, equipped, advised, and backed by the CIA. His name was Saddam Hussein. You never hear about it. Whenever they talk about Saddam Hussein over the last 5 years, they always start like he was born in 2001 or something, you know. So they resist democratization not only at home, but abroad. The capitalist state has two core functions. The first is obviously to maintain and advance the interests of capital accumulation, to keep that whole process going. And that's the one we on the left usually focus on. There's another function, which nobody seems to talk about much. That's the function of protecting the capitalist system against the capitalists, saving capitalism from itself, because it is a self-devouring beast. It will eat everything in sight, and when there isn't anything else to eat, or sometimes there may be, but then there's this other juicy thing that it sees, it can't resist, its own tail, and it starts to devour its own tail. There's a number of Latin American countries where you had near meltdowns. Brazil, remember that? I think Chile for a while. I mean, the most notably one in the late 90s was Argentina, where the whole thing went. That was a failure of the capitalist state to rein in the capitalists. They will go and they will plunder and they will pillage their own, if they can make a quick profit. If I could get the entire money stream that's going into this auto factory and walk away with $80 million, what the hell do I want the auto factory for? What do I care about that? I'm not interested in seeing that you get cars or refrigerators or food or clothing. I'm not in that business. I'm in the business of making a profit. Well, Argentina, it got so bad, you know what's happened since then. Workers started taking over these factories and businesses and refurbishing them and building them. Said, who needs the bosses? What did the boss ever do if we can just scrape together some capital and this and that? I remember talking to my friend Horacio, who's an Argentinian. I said, and these bosses are coming back then. He said, no, they're finished. They're out. Not true. They're coming back. Right now they're coming back claiming their property rights. Sure, they got a profitable business all again. They want to take it all over again and milk it and plunder it for all it's worth. We saw the same thing happening in the U.S. Charles Keating, he built Lincoln Savings and Loans. He built it of $200 million. You see, that's what it's about. Why bother making refrigerators? You got to get the costs, materials, deal with labor. Then you got to sell them, hope to make it back, realize your investment, isn't that? When you can just go and steal the money that's in there, just steal the money. He did. What did he get? 4 years in prison. Charles Keating did for $200 million. I know a lot of people. Don't raise your hand. Who would do four years if they can walk out then with $200 million? I think he had to give back 30 million. They never seem to have. I don't know where I put it all. I mean, here, I'll give you back something. But the point is, if everybody's behaving that way, the system as a system begins to collapse. So I, as the capitalist government, have to persuade you to not do that, you see. But if you've been doing that, you might even go to jail, unless you're Vice President of the United States and President of the United States. And I do think probably that the difference between the Democrats and the Republicans is that the Democrats recognize this second function. At least more Democrats recognize it. But they have a little bit more of a sense of trying to hold off the beast from devouring itself. Well, why go way, way back to Ken Lay? We can look right today. We may be facing a meltdown, the subprime hustling, the international bank run on the dollar. I mean, there is now an enormous debt, and you can't live on debt. Eventually, the whole system can collapse. Think Oh, What a Wonderful Life. Think of Jimmy Stewart in the bank, you know. But instead of a little town, think of the whole world.
You're listening to the rebroadcast of a very contemporary-sounding talk by the author, lecturer, and activist, Michael Parenti. He spoke in August of 2008, predicting the financial crisis that began a few weeks later. Parenti had come to the reception of an art show in an Oakland, California gallery. It was a warm day, and the sounds of traffic on Broadway came in through the open windows. The title of his talk was Capitalism's Apocalypse: Why the Rich Can't Save Anyone, Not Even Themselves. That title went well with the theme of the exhibition of collages by me, Mariah Gallardon. That was Toasting the End of Capitalism. Martin Spencer Davis and I made an audio recording as well as a film on DVD. And here's an edition for the 2018 rebroadcast of this talk. In a moment, Parenti will quote the numbers for the national debt: $5 trillion under the Bush administration, and doubled that for 2008, when this talk was recorded. At the end of 2017, the national debt has been doubled again to $19.8 trillion. Parenti will explain now why the size of the national debt matters.
And besides that trade debt, we have a national debt. The national debt is the money that the government owes to citizenry, both Americans and foreigners. And that has grown. When George W. Bush took power, the national debt was $5 trillion. It's now, as of this January, it will be $10 trillion. He managed to double it. The conservatives have discovered that the national debt is a very wonderful way of dampening spending on human services. It's also a marvelous way of undermining the federal government's ability to perform any functions for us. And it's also a means of privatizing the federal budget. The greater chunk of this budget that goes to just servicing this debt, the less money you have for anything else. So what you're doing is every time you're paying, every tax dollar you pay in, a larger and larger portion of it is simply being cut off and then put into the pockets of rich private creditors. So the government has for years now been borrowing money from the people they should be taxing. Meanwhile, cutting the taxes of those very same people so that they'll have even more money to borrow to the government. And all of this we pay for. We pay for that. That's the way the system goes. Now, giant corporate capitalism is, by its innate nature, its essence, an apocalyptic system. It is, when left purely to its own devices. The essence of capitalism is the transformation of living nature into commodities and commodities into dead capital, into just so many numbers in the book. So capitalism, while it's doing that, while it's transforming living nature into dead capital, is also foisting its diseconomies and toxicities upon the general public and the natural environment. I remember years ago in 1971 when I was teaching at the University of Vermont, I announced that the environmental movement is potentially subversive of capitalism. And I remember a couple of colleagues saying, you're getting carried away and don't, where are you going with that and blah, 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 that sort of thing. But I think it's true. And, you know, by the way, it's not true that the corporate class has ignored the environmental problem. Quite the contrary. They have vehemently and strenuously attacked it. They've attacked the environmental movement, calling them tree huggers and eco-Gestapo and this and that and all sorts of names like that. But Debs, getting back to Debs sitting in his cell, Eugene Victor Debs is sitting there, and he remarks that the extent to which life in an advanced industrial capitalist state, the extent to which it was bearable or decent or survivable, depended on the humanizing effects of democratic struggle. He was saying, I now see that the extent to which we could even bear this thing and even help it inadvertently, helping it to survive, is by trying to ameliorate its worst abuses and make certain changes so that we can breathe and live and find a little space where we can be human, you see. So we create little patches of community while this colossus keeps going on us. So that democratic struggle is part of the class struggle. That's what those struggles are about. That's what Debs was doing. He was doing class struggle. He was doing democratic struggle. He ended up, when he got out of jail, getting thrown back into jail by that great believer of democracy, Woodrow Wilson, for opposing World War I and saying this is a war that the working people of Europe and of America have no interest in. It's not something we should be fighting and all that sort of thing. He went back to jail for that one. So that class struggle and democratic struggle imposes restrictions. It forces some reforms and has restraints. But that's about it. Well, is capitalism a successful system? I mean, they've been crowing, you know, ever since 1991, too, with the overthrow of the Soviet Union. They've been crowing about capitalism is the successful system. It's the system that delivers the goods. It's brought us all this good life. Is it a successful system? I would argue yes and no, depending upon where, what is your position in the social order. You tend to see social reality according to the position you occupy in the social structure. And not only tend to see, it's not just a perceptual thing, it's also a actual material reality. Let's start with the capitalist leaders, those who are both state leaders, those who are rich, among the richest up there in that top fraction of 1%. It's not the top 1 or 2%. It's about 0.04 of 1% really, really owns the lion's share, most of what's going on. And they're the ones who make this enormous wealth. All right, George W. Bush is one of those people. And in August of 2008, which is still this month, The House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, came out with a statement. It's about time she actually said something confrontational and partisan. She said, George Bush is a failure in all of his policies. He's just a failure. I disagree. I think George Bush is a smashing success in almost every area. This massive debt that he's built up, you know, this massive increase in military budget, his ventures abroad, which have been very, war has been very good to George Bush, at least for a while it was. Now, that did backfire a little in terms of the polls and all that. The massive shift in the tax burden, that's massively been shifted from that top group, the undoing of the real estate tax, which they called the death tax, cutbacks and defunding of human services, including public education, environmental protections. He's been successful in all of that. He's not a total success. There's a couple of places he hasn't gotten through yet, Medicare and Social Security. So try, if you want to have a radical analysis and not just a liberal complaint, try to look at success the way the big money boys do. Capitalism is less than fully successful in countries like Norway, Finland, Denmark. Countries, you say, well, wait, they're very prosperous and all that. But capitalism is not interested in prosperity. It's interested in profits. Please don't confuse those two things. Okay, so that's where success lies. Indonesia, Nigeria, Colombia. That's the model. That is the success. That's the success they're looking for. Remember that. So capitalism makes a claim not only to democracy, but also to prosperity. But that's not true, as I've just been saying. The goal is private wealth for the few and public poverty for the many. To the extent that there is prosperity, it's because of, as Debs thought of it in prison, it's because of our struggle to create a minimum wage law, child labor law, Social Security, better wages and such. But their goal is the opposite. It's really to create poverty, because the poorer and hungrier you are, the harder you will work for less. I mean, why is it you won't work for 18 cents an hour or 14 cents an hour the way the Indonesians do? Is it because we Americans are just so much more self-respecting? We wouldn't consider it? No, it's because we're at a stage of historical struggle where we don't have to. But that goal is to get us back to 1900, because in 1900 we did work for pennies an hour. A half a century before the term was invented, the U.S. was a third world country. It had widespread underemployment. It had tuberculosis epidemics in some of the major cities and typhoid epidemics and the like. It had all sorts of desperation, no public health, no public education, well, limited public education in some areas, only up to grade school and such. And that's what they're trying to get back to. Now, let me just say that the reactionaries in the Republican Party have enjoyed over the last 30 years a remarkable success. Back in 1978, and I got the quote in an essay I wrote, which appeared in one of my books. The book is out of print now, Land of Idols. It was a group of plutocrats meeting and coming out and saying, this has got to stop. I mean, giving word to Jimmy Carter, who was president at the time, this has got to stop. I mean, where's it going to end? You guys have got this gain, that gain, this, that, the other thing. We're going to end up being a social democracy. I found it fascinating that he used the term. Fast forward 30 years. There was an article recently, an article I clipped from the New Yorker, dealing with the question that the GOP is having problems, which is they're getting a shortage of issues. They don't quite know where to attack anymore. And as one of them said, you know, we've achieved our goal, which was to prevent the United States from becoming a social democracy. He used the term again. These guys know what they're doing. They know what they're doing. This is not an analysis I'm superimposing on it. It's what they themselves think about and work on. And they have scripted, they have perfectly scripted and ideologized their approaches to things. So that's what we got to understand, the importance of ideology. And the fact is that their goal is to get us to Indonesia. Our goal at this historical stage, at least, is to get us to Denmark and then beyond. Yes. At least. Thank you so much for your kind attention.
That was the noted scholar, activist, and author Michael Parenti. This speech, Capitalism's Apocalypse, Why the Rich Can't Save Anyone, Not Even Themselves, was given only weeks before the financial crisis of 2008 began. Michael Parenti received his PhD in political science from Yale in 1962. His highly informative and entertaining books and talks have reached large audiences in North America and abroad. You can find a huge archive of films and audio recordings of Parenti's speeches on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Parenti was recorded by Martin Spencer Davis in an Oakland, California art gallery on August 23, 2008. It was the closing reception for an exhibition of political collages by me, Mariah Gilardin. You can find out more about this program and see photos of the collages on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Call anytime at 703-463-2654 for information on how to order. You can get your CD or a film of this talk on DVD by mail or online on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. My name is Mariah Gilardin. Thank you for listening.
Listen to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
You know, the whole criminal justice crackdown fits in that it can both physically control large elements of the poor and keep their communities under surveillance and police occupation, and also simultaneously ideologically control them by promoting a story of danger and threat and moral failure and individual responsibility that explains away high rates of poverty as cultural phenomena rooted in individual failures to get up early and work hard, etc., etc.
That's the voice of renowned author Dr. Christian Parenti. On this week's show, we speak to Dr. Parenti about the prison industrial complex and its relationship and growth with the rise of neoliberalism. So stay tuned.
someone who looks at the way surveillance has a role in this capitalist society is my next guest, Christian Parenti. Dr. Christian Parenti is the author of several books. His latest book is Tropical Chaos, and we talked to him today about his last two books, Lockdown America and The Soft Cage, which speaks about the prison system in North America. Thank you again for joining us.
You're welcome. Fire away. What are the questions?
Wonderful.
What do people not yet understand about policing in prisons in the United States? I've been having this conversation for nigh on 15 years now. And frequently there are these resort to economistic answers coming from the left. The right, of course, says, well, you know, we're trying to regain order in a society riven by crime, et cetera, et cetera. But then the left resorts to these economistic answers about, well, it's private prisons and the exploitation of prison labor. And that's not really the explanation.
I actually am glad that you said that, because I don't hold either one of those positions. For me, being from Latin America, I seem to think, or at least I feel, that there is a connection between the repressive nature of prisons and the culture of neoliberalism. I think that the violence is a productive force as well.
You were in a minority of people who correctly apprehend how the thing works. That's exactly right. And it's not just the culture of neoliberalism, it's the actual economic policies of neoliberalism that produce poverty deliberately and also unintentionally. They produce it deliberately. There needs to be a high rate of unemployment to keep wages down, so there's an element of deliberate production of unemployment. You know, if any time the economy gets going, you know, too robustly, there's always concern about keeping the, you know, determining what the natural rate of unemployment is and taking efforts to make sure that there are always people, more people looking for jobs than there are people to fill jobs, lest wages start being bid up and cutting into the capitalist class's profits. And unemployment is also created unintentionally because, you know, when you remove all the Keynesian social democratic forms of regulation and control, the business cycle is, you know, back in full swing. And so you get increased volatility, you know, more frequent bubbles and more frequent crashes. And in those crashes, as in the crash of 2008, and which carries on, there's production of massive amounts of unemployment, just sort of indirectly, unintentionally, you know, but as a result of the business cycle. So then the question is, in a capitalist society, if for the sake of keeping wages low, there must be unemployment, how are the poor to be managed physically? And how are they as a category, as a political category, to be managed? I.e., how are they to be managed discursively? How are they to be described? How are they to be explained to themselves and others to make them politically vulnerable to unburden the state and the wealthy classes of any responsibility for providing for them? And so that's where the whole criminal justice crackdown fits in that it can both physically control large elements of the poor and keep their communities under surveillance and police occupation, and also simultaneously ideologically control them by promoting a story of danger and threat and moral failure and individual responsibility that explains away high rates of poverty as cultural phenomena rooted in individual failures to get up early and work hard, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, one of the important things I think that we need to make is that this culture of internalizes also in the population a sense of self-blaming. I'd rather see that the prison system produces the criminal. You know what I mean? Like, they're both self-constitutive, right? As long as we create this culture of criminality, or instead of looking at the root causes, which you just addressed, the wealth inequality, the inequality, the wealth distribution, inequality, instead of addressing those issues, we instead create this narrative that the victims themselves become self-censoring. You know, I mean, we ourselves start to think, well, he must have done something. So I wonder if you could talk about that relationship, because I think that's where we're stuck, sure. Right?
And again, it works both physically and discursively. So you could say prison produces criminals in that it produces actual criminality. You know, if you go to prison, particularly when you're young, instead of going to school, instead of, you know, when you're being socialized, instead of learning a skill and learning appropriate social skills to operate in society and in the labor market, instead you learn how to operate in the criminal underworld, yes, prison definitely produces real criminality. People who come out, they're marked. It's harder for them to get, you know, they're legally marked. They have a conviction. It's harder for them to get a job. They have less skills, et cetera, et cetera. You know, to put it in mainstream parlance, you know, they have the equivalent of like a Rolodex of what? Of criminals, you know? So they know how to, you know, fence goods, sell drugs, whatever, whatever. So it produces actual criminality, but then it also produces the legal category of criminality, whether or not one is an actual doing moral harm or physical harm to others. You know, you can wind up back in prison. And basically, it produces recidivism because the laws around probation and parole are, you know, incredibly intricate and intense. And so it's very hard for people to be out on parole for very long and not violate their parole. And so, you know, in some states in the United States, you know, up to half of all the people entering prison are going in for parole violations. You know, it's usually not more than half. It's like, you know, in the high, like 40-something percent in major prison-holding states like Texas and California are going in for just routine violations, which is they, you know, they smoke some weed and they get drug tested, and conditions of their parole are that they're not supposed to smoke marijuana, and so boom, back in for a year or whatever. You miss a date with your parole officer, back in. So it produces prisoners by producing these infractions and producing, you know, sort of officially generated recidivism in which people really haven't committed important crimes. I mean, clearly, no matter how you feel about marijuana, and I know you guys generally up there in the Canadian Pacific Northwest have a kind of civilized view of marijuana. But, you know, I mean, even if one has some sort of backward view about marijuana and that it should be illegal, I mean, one would have to admit that missing a date with a parole officer is itself not actually a crime. I mean, there's not that much harm done to society. But, you know, that can land you back in state prison for a year in California or Texas or New York or Illinois. The prison produces actual social harm, actual criminal behavior, and it also produces the category and the legal mechanisms of recidivism, of just turning, you know, people who are no harm to others back into prisoners.
I want to talk about an interesting relationship that I think, well, a person can be incarcerated for stealing a loaf of bread, which, you know, if someone was hungry, I would personally not consider that a crime in a world where so many are denied the basic essentials. But a company can destroy an entire ecosystem and the entire livelihood of thousands of people and not be held criminal. Can you talk to this, to me, paradox?
In some ways, it's not really a paradox, right? I mean, it's a class society. Capitalism is a class society, and the government is both a mechanism of social control and an arena of social struggle. So there is some democratic accountability. You know, the legislative branch of governments in the United States are definitely, to some extent, democratically accountable. Popular forces can have influence on shaping policy, and the history of progressive reform in the United States is that history of popular progressive forces through direct action and protest and strikes and elections and operating in office, changing the laws, creating decent policy. But, you know, at another level, fundamentally, the state in a capitalist society is about reproducing the capitalist economic system, which has the capitalist class and the institutions that they operate through corporations at the heart of its agenda. And so, you know, this sort of legal criminality is part and parcel of the system. And, I mean, it shouldn't be a surprise. That doesn't mean we should accept it, of course. But, yeah, this is what happens when corporations are allowed to write the laws. And so, you know, I'm sure most of your listeners understand how that works. It's just like the privileges of vast economic power deliver these sorts of benefits. Be one a rich individual able to, you know, hire decent lawyers and delay, and beat some charges, or whether it's an institution that's such as BP, you know, getting away with hiding the evidence of the damage they've created in the Gulf due to their oil spill and negotiating what will probably turn out to be a penalty that's really, you know, a fraction of the overall cost to the government and the communities that depend on the ecosystem of the Gulf. And, of course, you can never actually, at a certain level, put a true economic value on an ecosystem. But, you know, to the extent that large parts of the regional economy depend on that ecosystem, you know, the damage is going to be far greater than what BP is, you know, eventually going to pay out through all of this. So, you know, this is what it appears to be. I mean, and I don't really, in my book, I don't really talk about white-collar crime. And I also don't talk about political violence, because those, to me, don't really require that much explanation. They are what they appear to be: large corporations using money to bend the law in their favor so they don't have to go to jail, pay fines, et cetera, et cetera. So, too, with political violence. Remember once when some talk, you know, based on Lockdown America, a former political prisoner asked, why don't you deal with political prisoners more? I said, well, because it is what it appears to be. I mean, why were the radical left, you know, armed elements of the 60s put in jail, hunted down by the FBI and put in jail? Because they challenged the state with violence. I mean, what is there to explain? You can then decide whether you think that's effective. You can decide whether you like their politics or don't like them, but like, what is mysterious about that? It is what it appears to be. A group of people challenged the state, and the state, with its overwhelming power, fought them and won and crushed them and used the prison system and the criminal justice system to do that. But prison, general prison population, it's not so clear. Why are there 2.3 million people in prison and, you know, upwards of 6 million people under the direct supervision of the criminal justice system, either out on parole or probation, having to, you know, take drug tests and check in daily or check in weekly or wear electronic monitoring bracelets, et cetera, et cetera. Why all of this? And why did this buildup begin in the 1970s and go through to now? Why were prison rates generally, the rates of incarceration generally stable from the end of the Civil War through to the 60s, and then suddenly there's this huge explosion? And so that is not as self-evidently apparent. You know, it's driving causes. So that's what I tried to explain. And it's, as you said in the beginning, you know, it's linked to the shift away from Keynesianism, away from a sort of burgeoning social democracy in the United States, rooted in the New Deal and Johnson's war on poverty, and a shift away from that towards neoliberal economic theory, you know, out with Keynes, in with Hayek and Friedman, and the idea that the state should remove itself from the economy. Of course, this idea is then violated in times of crisis and banks are bailed out, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, the theory is that the state must remove itself from economic activity, and first to go is, like, you know, social spending on all of the programs that support the working classes: assistance for healthcare, education, job training, et cetera, et cetera. And why was there that shift beginning in the late 70s and really taking off beginning in 1980 with the election of Ronald Reagan? It has to do with the fact that the world capitalist system in the 1970s faced a profit crisis. And from the end of World War II until the 1970s, the golden era of world capitalism, you saw across the West rising wages, a rising standard of living for the working class, at the same time that there were rising taxes, high rates of growth, and also really robust corporate profits. And so corporations and the capitalist class were okay, more or less, with the Keynesian compromise because they could afford it. They could still make really quite record rates of profit. Those profits, the sort of average across the economy after-tax profit rates, peak in the mid-late 60s and then decline precipitously into the early 70s, and that's when there's a rethink starting in 73 that really is a shift away from Keynesianism towards neoliberalism. So what was the cause of that profit crisis? It was basically that the world capitalist economy had finally recovered economically from World War II, that the devastation of World War II was so profound that it basically took a generation to rebuild. The other two poles of world capitalism, Europe and Asia, centered around Japan. And once that recovery was sort of mature and those core capitalist economies were built out, you had a classic crisis of overproduction, a crisis of overaccumulation. There was too much capital, too much money to lend, too many factories to produce blue jeans, washing machines, whatever else, electronics, and not enough demand for it, unless there was going to be some sort of radical kind of like deepening of the Keynesian compromise and an acceptance of low profit rates. The choice facing the capitalist class to restore their profit rates was to attack the working class so that the portion of the general social surplus produced by the economy as a whole that went directly and indirectly through, as wages and as benefits and social spending to the working classes, that had to be reduced so they got less so the capitalist class could get more, thus to restore profits. And that's exactly what the program of neoliberalism is and was. Cut tax rates on the highest income earners, cut corporate tax rates, allow for an expansion of loopholes, et cetera, facilitate the upward redistribution of wealth, and attack directly and indirectly all the facets of power of the working classes, attack labor. So, you know, that's what Reagan did. First thing he did was he comes in, he fires the air traffic controllers union. 11,000 people went on strike, and he fired them, and he was able to do this because actually a lot of them worked at government facilities, and you know, then stacked the National Labor Relations Board with people who were totally hostile to labor. And those are the direct assaults on working class power. And then indirectly, you know, there began this whole discourse of the culture of poverty, that, you know, the kind of racist myth-making and baiting about welfare queens, et cetera, et cetera. And so the whole population, not the whole population, but large parts of popular opinion really turned against the poor, turned against this new kind of imagined image of the poor as lazy parasites extracting unearned income from the hardworking masses. And so you get this sort of perfect stand-in. I mean, it's actually the actual rentier class collecting dividends fits the you know, they are the parasites essentially, and instead, you know, and the working classes do experience this extraction of from their labors, but then they are taught to falsely imagine that this is going to welfare queens and lazy people in the ghetto, et cetera, et cetera. And so there's like then a kind of actual popular consent built around the project of militarization, repression, incarceration of the inner cities, the highways, and increasingly all of America. I mean, this country is so over-policed, it's ridiculous. So there we are. We're still in the neoliberal moment. And there were moments where this was, right before 9/11, there was definitely a rethink was underway. And it was creeping into sort of elite opinion-making institutions like the New York Times and NBC, you know, were reporting on the criminal justice system in very, you know, not politicized Marxist terms, as I just laid out for you, but in, you know, very, very critically, you know, about the human rights violations, et cetera, et cetera. And you actually saw incarceration rates in the U.S. begin to plateau and dip right before 9/11. And then, in the name of the war on terror, we get a whole new round of fear and paranoia and massive, massive federal largesse to any and all state and local police institutions to buy new equipment for surveillance, incarceration, and policing. And so, you know, the situation in a lot of America is that the schools are totally underfunded and the cops have more gear than they know what to do with.
I want to talk, though, about the sustaining forces behind it, because while we understand, and thank you for making those points very clear, the relationship between this war on terror and the insecurity that it creates in the population, the way that people self-surveillance themselves and perhaps do not resist when they would otherwise, right? Because you create this culture of fear and everybody's running scared. And when we're all scared, well, business goes on as usual. Facing that fact, people in Latin America, we're seeing it more and more in Europe, we've seen it in other parts of the world, in Africa, are rising up and standing up. And I wonder if you could comment on this, because it seems to me that within the capitalist system, we're always going to be back to this, you know, 3 steps forward, 10 steps back, right? We get Keynesianism, then we get neoliberalism. You know, the next stage, right now, we have a world where these practices of the war on terror, the war on drugs are being systematized. So there's this interchanging of information, interlinking. They're united. What's it going to take for us to unite our efforts and resist this?
That's the key question, and I really don't have an answer. I don't have an answer to, like, well, what social movements need to do is X, Y, Z. I do not know. But I can say that I'm hopeful. I mean, I guess there's one thing I could add, but first of all, let me just say I'm very hopeful about this moment of protest, and I don't know what the correct thing for social movements to do is. Those strategies and tactics have to be worked out by the people in specific places, engaged in real specific struggles. But one thing I would say, as an intellectual, I mean, my job is, I mean, I've been an activist, but I don't deign to sort of claim that mantle. I'm not really an activist anymore. I mean, I'm a scholar. I teach at a graduate institute and write books, and I'm a reporter. And it's like, so one thing I would say is, I think we really have to take ideas and history seriously. I'm increasingly disturbed by how little history is in curriculum. I'm also increasingly disturbed by the role of technology. There's a whole kind of techno-bureaucratic enclosure of education, and people are increasingly concerned with the form of things and not their content. And I think that one major problem that the U.S. left faces is a kind of a lack of intellectually robust engagement with political economy and history, and that we too often resort to sort of moral explanations, individualistic categories, sort of methodological individualism to explain problems. We seek direct economistic explanations for things, and then that mentality lends itself to conspiracy theories that can sometimes be really wild and out there and really not helpful. And that the whole practice of analyzing and criticizing capitalist society and political economy requires, you know, a kind of thinking that we generally don't do. And part of it is that there's a very sort of utilitarian mentality, in, at least down here, this side of the border. People want to know what information is useful. What should we do about this? Let's critique this in a way that's actionable now. That's all good, that kind of tactical knowledge. But we also need to have a kind, you know, a deeper critique of the society, and that's not easy to do. That requires study and requires specifically reading history and thinking about institutions, about the large patterns in history, about the large long-term patterns of political economy, and to think amorally, you know, have one's ethics and morals clear, but when you approach a problem, think totally amorally about it. If you don't find the evidence that you want, accept it, confront it, move on. And that's getting back to my original comments. People look at this prison thing, and they're like, oh, it must be private prisons. Oh, it's prison labor. It's like, it's not. There are only 7% of beds are being run by private prisons. There's, you know, very few prisoners actually work for private corporations. Many of them work for state corporations, but that's about managing prisons. That's about making prison look efficient. The military makes stuff in federal prisons. It would be much cheaper for the military to buy that stuff on the open market. It's not about money making. You know, yes, there are interests that make money off of prisons. Yes, they lobby for repressive legislation. But all of this was not produced by that alone. Those parasitic interest groups are actually much more produced by the policy shift than the reverse of them having the private prisons and the guards having produced this profound, massive, now, you know, 35-year-old shift in U.S. criminal justice policy. So, you know, moving away from economistic and moralistic explanations to think more historically and amorally, and that doesn't mean you act immorally, but just to think really, really harshly, clearly about stuff. I think that's one thing that we could do better and do more of. Now, as for the rest of it, I defer to the comrades who are taking all the risks and, you know, devoting so much time to all this meetings and organizing, and I applaud them tremendously.
Thank you so much for being with us. My guest is Dr. Christian Parenti. He's the author of 4 books, Lockdown America, Police and Prisons in the Age of Crisis, The Soft Cage, Surveillance in America from Slavery to War on Terror, The Freedom, Shadows and Hallucinations in Occupy Iraq, and his latest, Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence. Thank you again for being with us.
Thank you, Sylvia, and talk to you again soon about Tropic of Chaos, hopefully.
Yes, thank you very much, and talk to you soon.
Okay.
Look forward. Bye-bye.
Bye.
We have come to the end of our program. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program available to campus and community radios. Please visit our website, www.latinwavesmedia.com, to hear previous shows, connect to our media projects, and access other resources, or to support our efforts by making a safe PayPal contribution. I am Sylvia Richardson. Thanks for listening.